All right. It is December 2nd, 2021, and tonight is our Project JFK CSI Dallas Presents Spotlight Series featuring our special guest, Bruce DeTorres. We've got some people in the room that are still coming in, and for those that are already in the room, thank you for showing up and attending our event. For those of you that may be watching this on our website at projectjfk.com or our YouTube channel, Project JFK, you'll be seeing the replay. Before we begin tonight, I would like to let everybody know that please make sure your microphones are on mute unless you're asking a question at the Q&A sessions. We're going to be breaking down Bruce's presentation into sections, and after each section, you'll have time for Q&A with Bruce. And if you don't happen to get in at that time, you'll be able to ask questions at the end as time allows. Let's see. If anybody has any problems with Zoom or the meeting, if you're watching this through Eventbrite, which some computers can do that, some devices, it's actually better to view this through Zoom directly. That usually fixes any audio and video issues. Also, I've explained in the past about Zoom. If you can make sure that you do a fresh reboot, you can still come back into the room anytime this evening. I'm going to put in the chat log real quick the meeting ID and the passcode. And I would like to make sure that if anybody would like to write it down, that way in case your link that you had could cause issues, take a look in the chat log real fast and write down the meeting ID and the passcode. That way you don't miss a moment of tonight's feature. All right, I'm going to go ahead and do a share screen real quick, and we're going to bring up our website. Okay, I bring this up for a couple reasons. Number one, any of you that have not visited ProjectJFK.com, please do so when you have an opportunity. Things get updated on here quite frequently. There is a donate button that's done through PayPal, and if you'd like to support what we're doing, our shows, document research, scanning, digitizing, keeping the lights on, you can make a donation here on our homepage, and you'll have your name put up on the wall of donators. So if you can, that would be great. We really appreciate that. I'd also like to point out on the events tab, not only gives you information about tonight's show, but also projects that we're working on upcoming. Our next journey meeting, the journey on the trail of the truth in the JFK assassination, that next meeting is going to be December the 18th, 2021. Between 1 and 3 o'clock Central Standard Time. Sometimes we go way over 3 o'clock. You're more than welcome to stay for as long as you'd like. And of course, those replays are always put up the next day. But the research conference that we did just recently, the one-day stimulus conference, we've had we had over 500 views on YouTube. You can always view our videos on our website. You can also click the watch on YouTube, and there you can click the like button, leave comments, any type of virtual handouts that we have. Those are listed here, such as the chat logs, Bill Simpich's handouts, and also our journey meeting replays. If you have not seen those are listed on our website as well. Any type of chat logs, those are there for your viewing. We also have MP3 downloads, so you can take our shows with you. The Journey Spotlight Series replays are in the red section. Again, handouts, chat logs, MP3s. So I've kind of tried to color code this for everybody. The joining meeting information, replays, and so on is in black. The spotlight series is in red. And anytime that you find something to do with one of our conferences, it will be in white. So if you look at those sections, red, black, and white, that helps you, you know, figure out what section you're into. So the next thing I'm going to click on here is our More tab. Click on the affiliated websites. And here you will find a plethora of websites that will take you directly to different research sites, authors, speakers, researchers. And here's our buddy right here at the bottom, Bruce DeTorres. You can click on his website. And this is where you can pick up his book, God, School, 9/11, and JFK, The Lies That Are Killing Us and the Truth That Sets Us Free. You'll be able to order his book through here. And also, there's information, there's reviews. So please check out his website. Again, it's brucedetorres.com. And you'll be able to find information directly on Bruce, upcoming events, Trine Day podcasts, and then also his appearances, which one of those was at our 2021 one-day JFK Signals Conference. So I'm going to go ahead and click stop share now, and we're back here. Looks like I don't have anybody waiting in the waiting room, so I'm going to got Bruce's book right here. I'm going to read the back cover. It says, God's School, 9/11 and JFK by Bruce DeTorres exposes the lies that are killing us. We are poor, miserable sinners who deserves God's condemnation and school's incarceration. Salvation and careers depend on doing what we are told. And the truth that sets us free, we are eternal love and consciousness, creating all we behold. The lies of 9/11 and the JFK assassination prove our government was hijacked by elites who strip our rights, wage wars of aggression, and accumulate unspendable riches as they seek to rule the world. The ideas of the American founding enthrone our sovereignty, our rights to be free, and oversee a transparent and accountable government. What is seen by those who die and return suggests eternal life and safety. The truth restores our sanity, braces us to play this game of life, and allows us to love each other as ourselves as we create the solutions that we need. So if you have not picked up Bruce's book and read it, I suggest you know, spend the money and pick up his book. It's very enlightening. It's one of the best books that I've read recently. It's not strictly just a book about the JFK assassination, the water cooler talk, as our friend John Newman has dubbed that. It explains a lot more. So I think, you know, it's definitely a very good book. And it's Bruce is obviously a great researcher, guest speaker. And I think that that made a lot of the decision on why he is our spotlight speaker this evening. I do want to announce that Casey Quinlan and Brian Edwards, my cohorts, are going to be in attendance, but they are running a little bit late, so we'll have to give them a tardy slip. Casey was a teacher, so was Brian, so we're just going to have to go ahead and have to give them the tardy for not being here on time. But with that, without further ado, I want to turn it over to Bruce. And he can give him an introduction of himself and explain the sections we're going to be talking about this evening. And take it away, Bruce. It's all yours. Please make sure you unmute.
Testing, 1, 2, 3.
There you go. We've got you loud and clear.
All right. Do you see... Whoops. You see that?
Yep.
It's great to be here. As David just shared, that's where you can find that, my book. And while you're at Trine Day, you can find many, 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 many great books that you won't find elsewhere. Chris, the publisher, Chris Milligan, for 20 years has been publishing books. Nobody else will. Information we are not supposed to find. Every week he interviews one of his authors. He's done about 150 books in the last 20 years. I help him with the podcast And we put an episode up every week. We've been doing it about 15 months now. Each episode is about a half hour. If go there and look at the titles, and you'll find some you're going to start listening to. It's an amazing curriculum. There's about 69 episodes now. TryingDay.com. You're a good reader, is what my first grade teacher told me. It was the first identity that I grabbed. I love to read. I call my life reading interrupted. Whatever I get interested in, I read. When I don't know what to do, I read. I love to read ever since I was a kid. And it started with books about Abraham Lincoln and also the Bible. When I was in first grade, she also made a comment, oh, they like to draw the beard. So I started reading about Abraham Lincoln, and my pastor gave me a Bible when I was really, really young, and I read the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. That was my deep, every night before, that's how I would fall asleep. And I would pray for every member of my family, my extended family, my aunts, uncles, cousins by name, God bless who, and just really, you know, thought about these two guys a lot. And when I was in sixth grade, I decided to be an actor, and thereafter also discovered the Marx Brothers, and this is a show business biography, Harpo Marx's autobiography, and really fantasized, oh, I'm going to be an actor, and started getting into the plays, and I was in sixth, seventh, eighth grade, and majored in it, and did that for years and years and years, reading, and just pondering what made him a great president? What made him a great human being, if not savior? And what made him a great actor? And how do you be great? What makes somebody great? That was a great obsession of mine. Oh, here's a bunch of plays. through the years, just having some fun, doing different things, and trying to get comfortable on stage, because speaking in public has long been known as the top thing most people are afraid of, even more than death, believe it or not. So the joke is, at a funeral, people would rather be in the coffin and give the eulogy. I don't know about that. And I did a summer in South Dakota doing summer stock, seven or eight plays in, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 weeks. It was a lot of hard work. Our first day off, we went to Mount Rushmore, and we stepped right over the little chain link fence that said no trespassing beyond this point. We climbed up to this point and got that shot. And then we climbed up around the back of Lincoln's head, and we sat there for a while, a group of us, because we realized, wow, the observation area facing Mount Rushmore has everybody with the built binoculars. So we thought, we're in white t-shirts, everyone just saw us go through the trees, and we're hiding behind Lincoln's head up around the right there. And we waited, and we thought, wow, when we go down, we're going to get arrested. Then they're going to call the artistic director. He's going to pitch a fit. It's our only day off for weeks. No one got arrested, but that was a lot of fun. And this is a play called Move Over, Mrs. Markham, and that's an actress named Donna. And I was asking her, what are you learning in your acting class back in New York? This was in Pennsylvania. And she said, let me do you. Let your performance come out of you in response to what I'm doing right there in the present moment. And that night on stage, it was like blinders were taken off my eyes, and it was a 180-degree transformation about acting, because no longer was I thinking about what am I doing and what's my performance and what should I do. I wasn't there to give a performance. I was there to watch hers and all my scene partners and follow their speeds and volumes and movements. And it transformed everything. And I got back to New York, and I started getting cast in everything I auditioned for, or so it seemed. I did a show written by Gordon Gaynell of Violent Femmes, and got written up in the New York Times, funniest and most, I can't read it because our screen gallery is in the way, but there it is. You know, that was amazing. And then I started paying attention in real life the way that I did on stage and had my mind blown because I could see really for the first time all kinds of habits and triggers and the way that I treated people who were close to me, that loved me or were trying to love me. I realized in my early 30s that I was a big jerk, that I didn't pay attention and care the way that I had just practiced and discovered the magic and power of paying attention and caring and really listening in real life. So for years, I've described my life as the first third, I practiced how to be an actor. For the last 25 years, I've been practicing how to be a human being. And it's all about paying attention and letting reality do the work. But this unleashed so much rage and grief at the lost opportunities of my life, the regrets, the fun I could have had, the fights I had picked for no reason because I was acting out childish patterns and programs. This floored me, and I was in that phase for a long, long time. And then I decided I'm going to stick around just to see what happens next. Just in case I'm wrong about even this, that, you know, my life is hopeless and I thought I would have been farther in my career. I would have had a lot more going on had I paid attention to real life the way I learned how to on stage. A friend gave me Think and Grow Rich. Okay. Great book. Everything's made out of energy. Okay. Thoughts become things. Okay. So after a while, I thought, all right, well, why? You know, why? Because things are made out of energy, you know, would thoughts become things? And I got one idea. Did energy burst into existence, if it did, in the Big Bang 14 billion years ago, and to become everything because it wanted to? Is energy the intention to exist? Do thoughts become things because they're made out of energy? Is the intention to exist the ability? I started reading about energy, and you discover quantum physics says consciousness, the way things are looked at that subatomic level, causes things to manifest the way that they manifest. So, that blew my mind like this. Now I'm getting a wonderful echo, David. Testing. Echo.
You're getting an echo. Suddenly.
It's like standing in a canyon. Well, I can push through it, but it's like being my own heckler.
Okay, hold on just a second.
Testing. Still there. Testing. Still there. Testing. Still there.
All right, give me just a second. Now I have the echo. Okay, well that's gone now.
Testing. Still there.
One. Okay. Anybody try it again, Bruce.
Testing.
There we go.
All gone.
All right. anybody that happens to have their microphones, if the only time your mic should be unmuted is if you are asking questions. The only person who should have their mic active is Bruce. I even keep mine on mute as well while he's speaking. So if we make sure that we leave our microphones on mute, except for our speaker, then we shouldn't have an echo. So let's try to keep up with that. Go ahead, Bruce.
Mind blown. Energy is the intention to exist. Testing. Okay. Energy is the intention to exist. Idea. Wow. And we are energy. We're here because we wanted to be. And all of our thoughts are made out of energy. And part of an element of energy is it attracts things on a similar wavelength. So I had just done a life review. All the reasons why I was a jerk for months and years, I kept justifying, wow, I was a jerk, it was hopeless. And as soon as you, I wanted to experiment with, if you want to find reasons why your life is perfect and everything worked out, you'll find them, you'll think of them, because your intention to see, find, and attract those things will attract them. Bottom line. In this idea that I had, reality is a completely spiritual, magical realm. It's a completely creative realm. I had just spent 30 years reading biographies and autobiographies of successful people in all kinds of endeavors. And this is the point. This is the literal point of Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. And I decided I'm going to write a book about energy and consciousness and the mystical, magical, wonderful, loving nature of reality. And my share screen won't work. So I'm going to stop share.
Yeah, stop share and restart it again.
And reshare. And push that. Push that. Nope, it won't share. So I will stop share. Share screen. Go back to that. PowerPoint. Outside. Let's see. Aha! So These are the first four chapters of my book, Common Sense, the Universe, Identity, the Internal Talking Mind, Energy, Consciousness, Reality. And these are some of the things that I read to confirm this perspective to the best of my ability. And I have, to my complete satisfaction, it may be false, but it works for me. See, part of the whole notion is we can choose our thoughts. If we don't, they will just keep rushing at us. So I got a job offer in Atlanta. I was in New York City, and I put the acting career on hold. And I found a little divey bar that did an open mic every Wednesday night. And I got on stage and rehearsed and practiced and tried out teaching all that I was learning about this kind of stuff to see, does it make sense to other people? And it did. It always does. And part of my job was to host business networking meetings. And I calculated about 1,000 of them over the course of about 10 years. And that was all about bringing the best out of others, to help others connect so that they could discover, wow, how can we help each other with all the people that we know, referrals, just to give leads and referrals for business and to become great at bringing the best out of each other. '9/11 happened in 2001. And in 2004, someone who impressed me said, look into it. the official story is a lie. So I did, and quickly found that it was. Loose Change, Zeitgeist, the movie, got me into David Ray Griffin, the new Pearl Harbor, and I obsessed about how could this possibly be, because up until then, I had always known that the Kennedy assassination was a farce, that there was a government cover-up, but it didn't do anything to me knowing that. This pissed me off, because I was in Atlanta, and that explosion right there is doing that to my two friends. I considered those buildings, after this happened, how I regarded those as landmarks. All you had to do was look around in Manhattan, and as soon as you saw those, you knew, okay, that's south, that's north, you knew where you were. Anyway, let alone the loss of life, and discovered what more and more people are discovering these days, how connected people like W are to something like Skull and Bones, and it's not just something to make fun of, nor is the Illuminati, nor are the other secret societies that are out there, nor are the claims of what a cabal, what a ripoff, what a scam the Federal Reserve System is, and all of our money, and what education does to us. This is a great book, The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. Big, fat book that teaches. So I'm on stage now. Jim Mars, Crossfire, dug into that again, Kennedy assassination. Now I'm on stage every week at the open mics talking about this stuff. Outraged, still getting laughs because it's what I can do. In 2011 was the 10-year anniversary of 9/11. So I, for the first time, I wrote down a teaching about 9/11 in 7 or 8 installments that I got up on stage and taught about 9/11. And then 2 years later was the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination. First time I wrote and organized it and talked about it at the open mic. And in 2014, these are not M&Ms. This is my symbol for mind-blowing Big Bang discoveries. Another idea, I'm going to wrap these horrors with the inspiring, the awesome, the incredible, the life-giving, the lovable and loving ideas about energy and consciousness and the oneness of existence, and that this is something of an illusion and there's only one of us here. I'm going to wrap all those horrors in the good news that life is a completely creative thing. And in 2020, I approached Chris Milligan at Trine Day, and I sent him the manuscript, and within a month or so, he said, I'm going to publish it, but I can't do it until 2021. And I said, well, when do you need the final manuscript? And he said, well, not till after the election, because some things are going to happen in 2020, don't you think? And this is what got published this year. And I had time. I studied the illness that can't be named on YouTube all of 2020 and have marshaled the evidence of how, yes, I do believe it is also not quite the truth. And it could fall into the category of a lie that is killing us. And these are the reviews that are on my website by folks whose books I had been reading. So giving this presentation right now for David and Casey and Brian and everybody who's here, this is pinch me, dream come true kind of stuff. That I was able to write something that has been this well received, and people want to know what I have to think about anything, because when you're nobody from nowhere and you're writing a book for years and years and years, you get up early, you stay up late, you just hope, but because life is short, you do what turns you on. So the first part, there's a deep dive, a deep examination of, you know, these are lies that are killing us. It doesn't get more serious than that. But first is the truth that sets us free. And in these I can't see the pages because the gallery's there. I think it's about 16 pages. I lay out the best case I can for reasons to be cheerful about how when we pass away, we just transition into another realm. We see more of what's really, really here. Because life is eternal, and every lifetime is eternal. It's always happening. So these are some of the ideas that allow people as an adult who are taking responsibility for every moment, every thought, feeling, and intention, every expression, because I'm affecting myself the same moment I'm affecting you. And I know crystal clear what my intention is. It's to enjoy life. And that's what I want for you, because according to this model and way of thinking, it's an illusion to think that there's two of it. There really is. There's just one thing here. And to call it you or me or we, it doesn't work. So in common sense, there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. I expand that. There's nothing but thinking makes it so. That brings it into existence. My idea, energy birthed into existence because it wanted to. It wasn't is its intention to exist. The intention is the ability. If true, we're here because we wanted to be. Thoughts come to us and become things because they want to. They too are and have the intention to exist. If we knew that to be true, we would choose our thoughts carefully to choose what we create. We would confirm what we were told to build lives on the truth. We have our work cut out for us. 70% of Americans identify as Christian. 90% of us go through public school. Christianity and school teach us to obey, not to choose our thoughts, broadly speaking. Obeying, we let our institutions trample our rights and kill people all over the world. Habits, such as obeying, are invisible. Oh, I can move that thing. Our habits must be looked for to be seen. They are strong from years of practice. They attack when they feel threatened, like anything that wants to exist. They have the intention to exist. They cannot be destroyed, only replaced. You're talking to an actor. Oh, you want me to seem to be an old British man? Give me a few days. Practice, practice, practice. We can develop new habits. I'm a drummer. You talk to any musician. You will be able to play an instrument. You can create new habits. When we resolve to choose our thoughts, we re-enthrone our sovereignty and self-govern. Instead of the thoughts we're used to thinking, the thoughts that are habitually in a loop and coming to us, the thoughts we echo back and forth with each other and that we echo from the media and the TV. When we choose our thoughts, we put ourselves back on the throne. We put our sovereignty back on the throne. When we see that the official stories about God, school, 9/11, and the assassination of President John F. Kennedy are lies that cause harm, we stop obeying liars and protect ourselves from them. Those who deceive intend to enslave. Those who would be free make the truth their God. So the next truth that set us free is every thought everywhere. Does that explain the coincidences that we experience? Or the remote viewing done by our military and intelligence services? Everything's eternal. Everything is everywhere. There is no, in reality, in the dimensions we can't see, there is no one thing after the other and then it's over and then it's gone. Are there infinite universes, infinite dimensions, infinite versions of every event, all possible past, presents, and futures happening simultaneously, perpetually, as science or science fiction can imagine? Are you and I wondering how spirit is perceived, like fish wondering how water is perceived? Is it all spirit? Is it all alive? Many people, revived from death, say that deceased loved ones welcomed them to an indescribably beautiful realm, where they felt an overwhelming love and knew that everyone and everything is infinitely and eternally connected. When we die, do we see what's really here? To see anything, we must be what can see it. To see our Creator, the intention to exist everywhere, makes this heaven. In the research that I did, poetry, the philosophy of the East, the Orient, mystics, Buddhism, psychics, echo, reflect, are just saying these kind of things. Zen in the art of archery, Zen in the art of motorcycle maintenance. We could go on and on and on. John Lennon wore a shirt that said, "You are here." Now, this is a nice metaphysical logic game I like to play. I am here. You are here. We're both here. Whatever here is, we both are. And you're not you and I'm not me. We're here. That's what we are versus what we might think we are. And you're either here or you're lost in thought. And when we're lost in thought, we turn to stone. And we run agendas on each other and we don't see and appreciate and we can't love what's here. And I say, and the poets say, that when we're just here, and this is what all meditation is and all relaxation is, to calm and slow down the busy, busy mind so that we can feel what's real and be here. And I say, and many say, what's here is really love. Everything, I got to move this. It's our gallery of faces. Go over here. Everything we could possibly imagine might exist in this realm or in others. Science, as well as mystics, can imagine. We might peer into infinity when we daydream. We might summon into this realm all we might like by welcoming it, encouraging it, making it feel great, as well as by buying or building it. Unfortunately, many of us have internal talking minds that do not welcome or encourage. They carp and complain. They talk to exist, to be the only thing heard. Our mind is a raging fire, said playwright David Mamet in a commercial for an online class. Thinking is that cruel tyrant within us, said John Adams. Its clamors, he said, can be hushed by genteel antidotes like cards and backgammon. Middle of the night, trying to sleep, wake up, racing thoughts. Okay, choose your thoughts. If you don't, they're gonna choose you. I was in a band. That's me on the right. Michael, enduring me in his ear, drew this picture. That's what I was to him, an internal talking mind attached to a mouth, oblivious to my effect on others. And that's what broke my heart when I learned how to pay attention to another human being. We have met the enemy, and he is us, because there is only one. I'm always describing myself. You want to know if someone's a jerk? They call people jerks. You squeeze an orange, you get orange juice. You poke a jerk, you get jerky things. My complaints about him and her and him and him and him and him are all the things I don't like about myself, because I see them and, ew, I wouldn't want to be like that, so I'm going to complain and hate and blah, 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 and poison this moment, which is the only moment you and I can experience anything. Ralph Waldo Emerson, another who echoes all these amazing ideas. There's a motivational speaker based in Florida who tells audiences we have to bombard ourselves with self-improvement and personal power and motivational material to overcome the tsunami of negativity, the oceans of negativity and fear that we are drowning in and that are fire hosed at us. And power comes with responsibility. You take 100% responsibility for every moment and detail and experience and happening in your life. And you've got power, how they affect you. Ralph Waldo Emerson in history wrote, "There is one mind common to all individual men. Every man is an inlet into the same and to all of the same." That's kind of a holographic model. Maybe we'll talk about that later. Every part has all the components of the whole. You could cut a hologram up, however finely, and each piece, you shine the light properly, it projects all the details of the image. Every man is inlet into the same and into all of the same. He that is once admitted to the right of reason is made a free man of the whole estate. But Plato has thought, he may think. Which reminds me of the idea in my book, we become what we behold. And we remain what we behold until we realize we're beholding. Then we burst into existence as someone who is beholding. Until then, we are that thing. We're captured by it. The idea, fear this, hate this, ooh. If you don't know that you're thinking it, there's a lot of people who aren't thinking their thoughts. Their thoughts are thinking them. So when you read Plato, you become him. You feel like him, especially if you take someone's writings and you transcribe them by hand. Now you're literally writing them. And you feel like, well, that's what it was like to create those things. And that's where our imaginations can take us. But what Plato has thought, he may think. What a saint has felt, he may feel. What at any time the person who has tapped into this one mind has befallen any man, he can understand. Who hath party to this universal mind is a party to all that is or can be done. For this is the only and sovereign agent. The universal mind, which is the only thing that exists in an infinite and eternal field of consciousness, is the only and sovereign agent coming into existence as you, coming into existence as me, perpetually flowing every single moment. And anything we want, we need to just declare it, say it, write it down, draw it, build it, and it can be attracted. I believe. Could be wrong. Fires me up. I get to think whatever I want. Self-reliance. We lie in the lap of immense intelligence, which makes us organs of its activity and receivers of its truth. When we discern justice, when we discern truth, we do nothing of ourselves but allow a passage to its beams. If we ask, whence this comes, if we seek to pry into the soul that causes, all metaphysics, all philosophy is at fault. How many angels can dance on the head of a pin? Well, was he dead for 3 days or 4 days? Its presence or its absence is all we can affirm, that it's immense intelligence. You're either aware of it, you've got a calm mind and an open heart to try to feel it, or you're worried about something. You're carping and you're complaining. Well, Bruce talks too much with his fingers during that part. As opposed to being wide open and here and just loving the show that this one thing is performing. Illusions. This is great. There is no chance and no anarchy in the universe. All is system and gradation. Every god is there sitting in his sphere. The young mortal enters the hall of the firmament. There he is alone with them alone. They pouring on him benedictions and gifts and beckoning him up to their thrones. On the instant and incessantly fall snowstorms of illusions. He fancies himself in a vast crowd that sways this way and that, and whose movements and doings he must obey. He fancies himself poor, orphaned, insignificant. The mad crowd drives hither and thither, now furiously commanding this thing to be done, now that. What is he that he should resist their will or think or act for himself? Every moment, new changes and new showers of deceptions to baffle and distract him. And when, by and by, for an instant, the air clears and the clouds lift a little, there are the gods still sitting around him on their thrones,
they alone with him alone.
That's the picture I have drawn, oh, probably hundreds, if not thousands of times, just doodling it. That's the infinity symbol with a little smile, a little happy. Someone close to me looked at that and said, oh, infinite happiness, because he saw like that. Oh, that's the symbol for infinity on its side. Everything coming and going. Science says that all energy is constantly blinking in and out of existence. Okay? It's never always just a particle. It's never just a wave. Oh, so fast that we've got this continuity of experience, but we're always blinking out of existence. From whence we came, the infinite resource and coming back, and those who create, and the shamans and the mystics leverage this power. You could call it magic. It's sometimes beyond words. But anyway, that's my friend, and here's another friend, Leaves of Grass by Walt Whitman. Beginning my studies, the first step pleased me so much. The mere fact, consciousness, these forms, the power of motion, the least insect or animal, the senses, eyesight, love. The first step, I say, awed me and pleased me so much I have hardly gone and hardly wished to go any farther, but stop and loiter all the time to sing it in ecstatic songs. Remember, I had my head up my butt and it whoop, popped out on stage, and I felt the love of someone looking at me as if I was worth looking at, and the love of looking at her as if she was worth looking at and sharing that love. The astonishment of just being able to pay attention gives me my appreciation of what this man has to say. And on page 9, I write, our urges must be examined and comprehended, and self-control acquired if we would live together in peace. Peace requires trust. Trust requires the truth. These ideas give hope, which we need to face life challenges, and they let us have fun, which lives in what we share. Fun is in what we share. You want fun, you got to share something with others. David, you asked for a cue. Who's got the first question?
Who's got the first question? Anybody have a question for Bruce so far with what we've talked about, what he's talked about? You can either type it in the chat or ask it directly to him if you'd like.
Viewer? Who's got the next question?
Well, maybe we don't have questions right now.
No problem.
All right.
No, I'll talk.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, it's very fascinating. Thank you so much. Because the question I have is, I have been compelled throughout 2020 to return again and again to my investigation of the JFK murder, and I just can't seem to get away from it. And each time I go I'm just going into and researching people that I never ever listened to or read before, and I'm learning new nuggets and nuances of the deception. And I agree with you that we created this communally. It's not, we all did this together, this delusion and distraction. We participated in it, and we are now participating in the delusion of the lies that are being foisted on us through the COVID agenda. And it's all intertwined somehow, and I don't quite understand why I keep coming back to JFK's murder as a touchstone for understanding what's happening now. Maybe you can help me understand how it's all like a circle. I mean, you've touched on it, but it's all a wheel, and I don't quite know how to get my hands around it, other than it feels like it's a continuum of our exploration, of our evolution towards understanding that we are all one, that I am you and you are me.
Well, when I need a day off, Gail, I know who to call to give my presentation, because I couldn't have said a lot of that better myself. Thank you. Two quick things. I have an obsession with John F. Kennedy. It's getting satisfied these days. I will say that. There are days when I'm, and it never was a burden. It never was a torture. It was a sublime pull, because the magnitude of his sacrifice, the magnitude of his doing what he did with eyes wide open, I'm going to talk about shortly in this presentation, but I totally relate to how you described your thoughts about John F. Kennedy. And I'll leave you with this about the implications you're finding that it's all one and we've done all this. Yes, Gail. And I think this for myself and for everybody, whether or not we know it, and I feel very lucky to have this perspective. I wanted this. I wanted every moment of my life. I want every detail of it right now. I'm creating it so I can choose how am I going to respond to it? What am I going to make out of it? And everything that comes, you can't scare me, because your friend Bruce believes we're all the only thing that exists. I do it to myself. There's a story about a survivor of the Nazi concentration camps that I love, and I say in many, many of the conversations about this kind of stuff. Way after the war, someone asked him, how did you survive? Besides being exterminated, so many died from illness and bad treatment and despair. How did you survive? And the survivor said, they could beat me, they could starve me, they could make me sleep in the snow, sleep on concrete, but the guards couldn't make me stop loving them. I can't stop pondering the lessons, what I take from that. What do I want to make from that little story? I can make whatever I want of it. Make of it what you will. But love wins. Any other questions?
Yeah, there's a question in the chat log. It's from Lori Fenton. She asks, is there any specifics about 9/11 to share?
Coming.
Or going to get into that. Okay, great. We'll begin with that.
And I just wanted to also say that, you know, it took.
Yeah, Gail, if you've got a quick comment or a quick question, because there's a finite amount of time in this presentation that we're managing.
Okay, I'll hold off then.
No. But just succinctly.
It took us 50 years to really get it that we had been deceived with the JFK murder, most of us. And now it's only taking us, you know, a year maybe to understand the level of deception with the COVID agenda. Time is the truth, the process of coming to awakening is highly accelerating. And I just find that fascinating.
Indeed, I completely agree. We live in mighty interesting times, and you're absolutely right, and you're paying attention, and you're doing some thinking, you're doing some critical analysis about current events, and that's why you've said what you've said. And for myself and anyone else who's going to talk about the illness that can't be named, because this video is intended to live on YouTube, we've got to be very, very pandering and condescending and careful how we discuss it. You all know why, because no one wants the channel canceled or the video deleted or anything like that. David, anything else?
No, I think we can go ahead and move on to the next section.
And so we shall. We're going to explore some lies that are killing us. First, God. Organized religion. In the United States, around 70% of Americans, 77 out of 10 Americans identify as Christian. I did. That's one of my Bibles. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Just loving those stories. Loving them. Okay? How is that a lie that's killing us, you ask? Thomas Jefferson wrote, "It's an insult to our citizens to question whether they are rational beings or not, and blasphemy against religion to suppose it cannot stand the test of truth and reason." So we're going to have some courage here. We're going to, with a lot of respect, we're going to talk about some things that most people don't. And Thomas Paine wrote in The Age of Reason, "I know that this bold investigation will alarm many, but it would be paying too great a compliment to their credulity to forbear it upon that account. The times and the subject demand it to be done. The suspicion that the theory of what is called the Christian Church is fabulous, a fable, is becoming very extensive in all countries. And it will be a consolation to men staggering under that suspicion and doubting what to believe and what to disbelieve to see the object freely investigated. I therefore pass on to an examination of the books called the Old and New Testaments." And Spinoza, whoops, what happened? Here we go. "In Ethics said, those who wish to seek out the cause of miracles and to understand the things of nature as philosophers and not to stare at them in astonishment like fools are soon considered heretical and impious and proclaimed as such by those whom the mob adores as the interpreters of nature and the gods. For these men know that once ignorance is put aside, that wonderment would be taken away, which is the only means by which their authority is preserved." And Jefferson again, "For I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of men." And that's what we shall put our toes into right now. In my chapter on God, which is an examination of Christianity, for which I feel completely qualified due to the years of devotion and contemplation and activity and involvement, I look at it very, 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 very matter-of-factly, very logically to help, because it sets me free not to fear what it caused me to fear. Right before this passage, I talked about democide. The government's killing their people, and said, well, that's very unlovable. It's hard to love that. Also unlovable would be a God who punishes us for things done by others, Adam and Eve. Because follow this. I'm trying to make the unconscious conscious here about this. If God is unfair, why should we be fair? Why should we care about ourselves or each other more than God cares for us? Many of us kill ourselves with unhealthy food, drugs, alcohol, and lifestyles. We let corporations run our government. We let our government destroy our rights, kill innocent people in wars of aggression, and cripple our children's future with unpayable debt. We excuse our contempt for life, dodge responsibility, and boost our egos by telling ourselves we are too smart to be cheerful, too smart to have hope, too smart to waste time trying to fix things. We know we can't compete with the powers that be, certainly not with the God who made things this way, and quit before we start. Earlier I talked about we are that God force, the intention to exist, and the delight and joy of taking responsibility for the way things are. And organized religions, Christianity, Islam, make God an other. Whatever God is, it ain't us. We ain't it. Whatever's going on, it's not our fault. It's the big man. And if he's doing all these horrible things, why should I not do horrible? Why shouldn't I just selfishly look out for number one? Moving this thing here. Were you paralyzed as a child picturing Christianity's satanic scenarios? Do you inflict them on your children for the same reason victims of domestic abuse and pedophilia as adults often create victims of their own because someone did it to you? Does believing that God is watching and judging us make it easier to let our government and our employers watch and judge us? Does it encourage us to watch and judge and loathe and condemn ourselves and each other? Do we think we are being godlike and good Christians when we watch and judge ourselves and each other? I examine the Catholic Church at great length in my book. To this next column, the love and kindness of Jesus, whether a real or concocted character, are the main appeal of Christianity, powerful enough to override its absurdities and inspire many, including Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., to help others in self-sacrificing ways that astonish. Certainly, it's what I love to think about as I was reading the Gospels over and over and over. When asked if he accepted the historical existence of Jesus, Albert Einstein said, unquestionably, no one can read the Gospels without feeling the actual presence of Jesus. His personality pulsates in every word. No myth is filled with such life. But many things can save us. Many things can inspire us to love each other. There are a lot of good people on the planet who are not Christian. Imagine that. That's hard to imagine if you're a committed Christian. It's hard to imagine. Many things can inspire us to love each other, to pay attention to life, to ponder psychic and spiritual powers and wonder what they are and who might have them. We need only see how nature and intentions work, how people and different thoughts and decisions make us feel. We need only discuss these things without boundaries, fear, or coercion, without distractions, loud TVs, cell phones, a 24/7 litany of horrors, and too much to do. The biggest religions are used to breed an us versus God and us versus non-believers mentality. That creates fear, dependence on our sect, and hostility with existence, which makes our true nature harder to find and life harder to love. It is animal instinct to do what mommy and daddy do. If we worship a super daddy who crucifies himself, we will tend to do likewise, and we will crucify others. If it's good enough for God, it's good enough for them. These are the ramifications as I experienced them and thought them through for myself, to set myself free from a belief and imaginings and trying to put the pieces of life together in a way that caused too much anxiety, way too much fear, way too much powerlessness. And that's why I put this out there for consideration, because they helped me. Hopefully these ideas help rather than antagonize. Thomas Paine, Age of Reason. First, that the idea or belief of a word of God existing in print or in writing or in speech is inconsistent in itself for these reasons. The want of a universal language, the mutability of language, the errors to which translations are subject, the possibility of totally suppressing such a word, the probability of altering it or of fabricating the whole and imposing it on the world. Secondly, that the creation we behold is the real and ever-existing word of God, in which we cannot be deceived. It proclaims his power. It demonstrates his wisdom. It manifests his goodness and beneficence. Thirdly, that the moral duty of man consists in imitating the moral goodness and beneficence of God manifested in the creation toward all his creatures. That seeing, as we daily do, the goodness of God to all men, the sun, water, birds, animals, green grass, delicious food, people to love and be loved by, it is an example calling upon all men to practice the same toward each other. And consequently, that everything of persecution and revenge between man and man and everything of cruelty to animals is a violation of moral duty. It is certain that in one point, all the nations of the earth and all religions agree. All believe in a God. The things in which they disagree are the redundancies annexed to that belief. And therefore, if ever a universal religion should prevail, it will not be by believing anything new, but in getting rid of redundancies and believing as man believed at first. Adam, if ever there were such a man, was created a deist. But in the meantime, let every man follow, as he has a right to do, the religion and the worship he prefers. We are all in show business. Every word we say to each other is to persuade each other to see reality the way that we see it. We're all trying to define reality with every word that we say. And to strip things down, like I talked about earlier, to something we can be sure of, I love thinking this. There's only one thing that we can be 100% sure of. We're here. Everything else is up for grabs. I might be wrong. You might be wrong. And when we talk to each other, if we know we could be wrong, we can be really relaxed with each other and say, well, maybe this, maybe that. Why did he do this? Well, maybe this, maybe that. What do you think's going to happen? Well, maybe this, maybe that. Maybe something good, maybe something horrible. Everything's maybe, except for we are here. What do we want to do right now? What would you like to do? The infinite potential. Oh, and science says what we call energy is could best be described as infinite possibilities. Or is it a wave or a particle? It just becomes stuff. What causes it to become stuff? Well, the way we look at it. You mean our intentions? Now we're back to the whole first half of the... So, school. I'm watching the time, David. I'm watching my accordion of time and words, and it's all going to come together perfectly. No. I just wanted to plant that seed to know, like, I'm aware of the pace I'm going, and we're going to get there. We're going to get there. I got lots of breaks in here for questions, but I'm going to get through this school section before the next. Thank you. Good old school. God school, 9/11 and JFK. To survive, birds have to fly. If they can't fly, they can't survive as a bird. You can put them in a cage, then you have to take care of it. It can't survive by itself. It's captured. It's your pet. To survive, it has to fly. Humans have to make decisions. That's how we fly. That's how we survive. If we can't make decisions, you can put us in a cage. You have to provide for us, but we really can't survive without you. We're dependent on you. We're your pet. We're your slave if we're not making decisions. And that's why school is a crime against humanity. It doesn't let us make decisions until we're full-blown adults. And you look at America's explosion of suicide and suicide attempts and alcohol and drug addiction and cell phone addiction and internet addiction and online porn addiction and gambling addictions, anything to not be who we are, freaked out by the overwhelming fear of not knowing what to do or how to evaluate it because we were not allowed to make decisions during our formative years by the crime against humanity called school. I gotta move this to see what that says. Yep, if we don't make decisions, we're slaves. President John F. Kennedy said, to govern is to choose. So to self-govern, which is what America is supposed to be all about, is to choose for oneself. School doesn't let us choose anything for ourselves. We have to just do what we're told. It just teaches and trains us in obedience. To be human is to choose. We don't get to do all that. We get to go to the cage called school. Amazing, amazing books. Deliberate Dumbing Down by Charlotte Thompson Isabeat and The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto show how education was transformed in the 20th century, late 19th century into the 20th, by the Rockefellers and their kind. It was transformed from literacy facts and the empowering ideals of the American founding to operant conditioning, which trains us like dogs, and moral equivalence, so we can't know right from wrong. We can't conceive of rights. We can't think that rights are sacred. We can't imagine that they can be violated. And we can't make decisions with ease because we don't know what's good, bad, right, or wrong. Moral equivalence. When faced with the need to make decisions, which life inevitably presents, we default to our training, our habit, what we did. We learn what we do. We run to the boss. We've been trained to obey. In school, it was the teacher. Or we do what we've always done once we're out of school. We do what everybody does. That's our custom. That's our habit. That's what's normal. That's what we do. We don't think and choose and evaluate for ourselves. When asked, what do you want? Many young people seem perplexed, as if they've never been asked that question before. Or they seem annoyed, as if it's absurd to think that they would know what they want. They seem to want what they had in school. Someone to tell them what to do and everyone to leave them alone. Penning the weak and the meek with the strong and the cruel in school makes bullying a natural result of this unnatural situation. It is unnatural to take children away from the adults who love them and force them into a cauldron of frustration. We learn what we experience, not what we were told. We learn what we do. With school's restrictions, cops and cameras, children experience and learn that freedom is dangerous. They should avoid it because they're dangerous. Without constant supervision, surveillance, they will hurt themselves and each other. You're a savage animal. You've got to be watched the whole time. This is what children experience in schools with cops, cameras, and surveillance. They should not trust themselves, their thoughts, nor each other. Parents can stop asking, what did you learn in school today? Every day in school, children experience and learn to obey authority, to initiate nothing. Like circus elephants chained by a leg when young, so a rope on that leg tied to nothing when they're full grown keeps them still, unaware of their power, the power they were never allowed to use. Perfect consumers and workers for the rich oligarchs who captured the American government. And in this chapter, I review homeschooling. There's lots of facts, figures, and statistics. I review literacy and life in the 19th century. Do I idealize it a little? Well, I guess if I claim that's what life was like for everyone, that would be an oversimplification. But it certainly was true for so many. And if when people are doing something well, that's getting better results, even if they're a small percentage of the population, that's what to aspire to and emulate. Walt Whitman. I am the hounded slave. I wince at the bite of the dogs. Hell and despair are upon me. Crack and again crack the marksmen. I clutch the rails of the fence. My gorge ribs tinned with the ooze of my skin. I fall on the weeds and stones. The riders spur their unwilling horses, haul close, taunt my dizzy ears, and beat me violently over the head with whipstocks. He could imagine what it was like to be others. He knew you become what you behold. To have compassion, he had a big heart. You could imagine. One discovers in my chapter on school the Carnegies, the Rockefellers, and their encroachments upon creation of the boards and the schools that would control and inflict education on healthcare and healthcare on America, medical profession, petrochemical food and medicine, up to current times with autism and the explosion of chronic diseases, the establishment of Skull and Bones in 1832 at Yale University, infiltrating major institutions of power, to inflict all this on us. Read, converse, make decisions, develop your mind. I discuss all this, how on C-SPAN college professors in a panel were saying their students, college students, inability to pay attention is a crisis. Talk about the impact of addiction to cell phones. Dr. Bruce Lipton and his work, The Biology of Belief. The first 7 years of life, we're in a super learning state. And what we see, experience, and practice, and observe, super learning. How to relate to each other, who's got the power in our family, ingested into our subconscious instantly, and it becomes our programs that run us for the rest of our life until we're frustrated and ask ourselves, why do I do what I do? And you start to make the unconscious conscious. The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron is a great book. Can't read spiritual approach to higher creativity. Write physically with a pen in your hand. Write. Do these exercises. Magic happens. Tons of people made this a bestseller 30 years ago. I love this book. I can't praise it, recommend it highly enough. Because if we can't write well, Orwell wrote, we can't think well, and then others will do our thinking for us. Reading and writing. Develop the muscle of your mind. Why'd that author say that? Wow, why am I encountering 4, 5, 6 authors who are making the same observation about life? Am I going to observe that in real life? Critical thinking doesn't happen in school. It's 1984. Societies has looked, ours has looked like it for a number of decades now. This is worth it. Know thyself. Halfway down, Julia Cameron, right hand by every morning. Know thyself. Was supposedly carved on the temple of Apollo at Delphi. It's a command requiring work. When you know yourself, you can stop doing and creating unconsciously by habit and start living and creating intentionally. You can transcend who you just happen to be, who Bruce Lipton says, that's just what you observed and concluded by the time you're 7, what Mahatma Gandhi called the accident of his personality, and you can choose what to do next. Like the Star Child in 2001, Space Odyssey by Arthur C. Clarke, and brought to the screen by Kubrick. The second and third inscriptions on that temple were nothing to excess, and surety brings ruin. Don't get carried away. Question everything, especially those in authority. If they are good and honest, they will show us their reasons to earn our consent. If they keep secrets, they are doing things we would reject. Things that only help them.
David.
Who has...
All right. Well, so we've got the first question from the previous section.
David, I'd like to ask a question, if I may. Patrick McCarthy.
Yeah, go ahead, Patrick.
All right, this is about... it's about the JFK case, but it's also about somewhat of a philosophical bent that this Mr. De La Torre says, which is this. I'd like to get your take on a common myth, which is that it has been bruited about, and I think Manchester was one of the first to popularize it, that people who don't believe in the lone nut hypothesis are fearful, and so they create a conspiracy theory. Now, I think this is the opposite of the truth because...
Could I interrupt you? Could I interrupt you real fast?
Yeah.
Could you ask this at the end of the JFK section?
Sure. Absolutely. All right.
Who's got the next question?
Hey, Bruce, this is Casey. How you doing? Can you hear me?
Yes. How are you?
Good. A little observation here and maybe a little explanation of who or what I have been my entire life. I taught school for 45 years, and I was kind of like I was not the typical teacher, okay? I didn't fall into any cookie-cutter form, and I'm sure David would probably tell you that, my former student, and I can see him over there laughing. But at the same time, I was the type of person that loved to go to parent-teachers conferences because I wanted to talk to the parents, and I wanted to have their student there, and I wanted to say, this is what your son or daughter is doing. The good majority of the teachers they hated it because they didn't want to converse with the parents because all they had was bad stuff. And I said, you know, use a little bit of psychology here. The psychology is that if you're going to go to a parent teachers conference, you better have at least one good thing to say about that son or daughter. And you better start off by giving that explanation right up front. And of course, I'm a psychology minor, and I used a lot of that in teaching. But I also want to point this out, too. I grew up a Catholic for about 12 years, and I'm not a very good Catholic right now, and there are reasons for that. But I guess one of the reasons why I'm involved in doing the research on the murder of JFK is probably it goes back to a religious question and an idea that was pumped into our system at the high school level. And finally, I mean, I had the question when I was a sophomore, but I didn't want to ask it because I was fearful that, you know, God was going to strike me dead, okay? But by the time I was a junior, I just said, I've had it. I said, I'm putting my religion grade on the line where my mom and dad are spending extra money to send me to this school. But I said, I don't care. I said, I'm going to ask the question. And the question was this, and I was serious about it, but a lot of my classmates were looking at me like, what in the hell are you trying to do? Okay, well, the first question that I asked was, especially about religion, is that if I understand correctly that the Virgin Mary was a virgin, and God, everybody in class turned around and started looking at me, and I just said, okay, is that correct? Yeah, okay. Now, and we're talking about a Hebrew girl that is probably going to be probably about age 12 or 13 at that particular time that she would be ready for marriage, to have children. And I know we can go back and break history down, try to figure out when that was. But I had to ask the question. I said, you know, I said, my problem with this, and it's probably a deal with faith, but I said, okay, I want to put myself in Joseph's shoes, and I want Mary to come home to me and say, Dad, I have not been with a man, but I am pregnant. I am filled with the Holy Spirit, and everybody was looking at me because I know that they wanted to ask the question, and I just sat there and I said, would you like to explain that to me on a logical, something that I can take with me? And it was as if, wow, the lightning bolts are all over the place. My God, I'm gonna fail this class. Well, I got a D out of the class. I thought my dad, being a former Marine, is gonna kick my butt all over the place. But, you know, the answer I got was, Mr. Quinlan, it's a matter of faith. And I said, you know, I said, do you know what name I took on my confirmation? My confirmation name in the Catholic Church was the Apostle Thomas. And I said, you do know who Thomas is. Doubting Thomas. And I think that is one of the things which I've asked over the years. I would question everything. That's how I approached my class. My class was, I'm going to open you guys up. I said, here's a book about 1,200 pages, which is an American history book. And one of the very first things I did is I just tossed it in the trash. And every I passed the trash can around, and I had every kid. I said, if you'd like to, go ahead and put it in the trash can. God, everybody was doing it, and they were slamming it down. And finally, I just said, okay, now do I have everybody's attention? I said, somewhere down the line, you need to explain what history is to me. And then we can go back and forth. But I said, do you think we might need a little help on what that is? So maybe we ought to start in the trash. So we would use that book as a basis to try to explain something, even though that we knew right down the line that for the most part, that is just one explanation of this. And I wanted to point that out because my classroom was a very open classroom. My students wanted to be in my classroom. And, you know, one of the very first things I know that we usually did when we opened up classes, we had sets of rules and regulations. And I go, good God, we got that for 2 days. I said, let's forget about the rules. Forget about the regulations. I want you guys to learn something. But as you learn something, I want you to be able to teach me something. I said, I'm the teacher, but I'm going to manifest this stuff in you guys. But at the same time, let's go from there. But I wanted to let you know that in using and growing up in the Catholic faith and the Catholic religion, that's what I kind of got out of that. But at the same time, I would ask the question. That's what I wanted my students to do. But in order to ask the question, I mean, you're going to have a lot of kids ask a lot of questions. And you can sit back and say, no, I don't want to answer that question. Well, yeah, you asked the question. I offered you to ask the question. Let's figure out ourselves what the answer is. And I would throw it back on them. What do you think the answer is? And they said, well, we asked you. And I said, well, I know, but what do you think the answer is? I said, I can give you what I think it is, but that is for me. And we can take that because I'm a little older than you and say, okay, maybe he understands this a little different. So that's how my classrooms were taught. And at the same time, you know, we had curriculum where we had to do a whole bunch of stuff. And since it was a Catholic school and things like that, we had to teach religion and that too. But at the same time, wow, you've hit on some major things that I brought into the classroom as a teacher. So.
Thanks. Thank you. I could reply to that, but I want to courteously see if anyone else has one more, maybe quick question after this section before we go forward. Is there anyone else?
I've got a question here from someone in our chat log. This is coming from Peter McKeever, and he says, why do people have such a strong psychological instinct to protect their worldview, which usually includes support for the prevailing unorthodoxy? Is it learned or innate? It seems to be an existential instinct and reminds me of the way in which people react psychologically to severe injury to the body, etc.
It seems to I'm just we are social creatures. What does that mean? We're very much a herd creature, which is why the current conditions are driving us crazy and there's so much despair, because we need to be in the same room with each other. We need to interact. We need to, we just need it. Otherwise we go nuts, literally. So there's a lot of anxiety right now because we're so separated. But why do people go along with each other, basically, is your question. And it touches on how I like to think of the bell curve of humanity. It's a statistical model that says in any group of a certain kind, most of that group tend to act or respond in the same way. And on the fringes, you've got some extremes. So I think of humanity as most humans are good-natured, go-alongers. Everyone's going to watch this TV show and talk about it. A huge percentage are going to watch that TV show and talk about it. Why? It's quote-unquote everybody does. Oh, and then all of a sudden there's a backlash against that TV show. And if once enough folks like seem to be against something, oh, now we're going to be against something. The antidote is to ask oneself, why do I think what I think? What do I make out of it? What do I want to make out of it? And this vast majority in the middle is swayable. And it's especially swayable by the truth. And I'll conclude this little example by saying when someone good comes along, it's because they're based on the truth. They're telling the truth. The truth does all the work. John F. Kennedy, as a president, as a candidate and as a president, defined reality in such ways that made so much sense. How should we relate to the Soviet Union? How should we relate to Black Americans? That he was pulling the country easily. He worked very, very hard because you have to bombard with a message to turn people in a different direction, which was unacceptable to the fringe of humanity who are psychopathic lunatics who are addicted to having power over others. This is the quintessential un-American quality. I want power over you. You're going to be my slave. You don't have rights. I don't need your consent to go to you. And the psychopaths in charge of our world, our corporations and our media, who want all that, know that the more they can divide us and separate us and fragment us until we are isolated individuals, the easier we are to control. And it's also why credibility numbers of Congress and the media are dropping, because they're not based in reality like John F. Kennedy. They're not making sense. Which is why, like what Gail talked about earlier, things are accelerating because they're trying to inflict so much power and control over us. They're making more, less and less sense. It's practically ludicrous what we're told to believe from day to day, and then the story changes. That's the short answer to that. Thank you for that. We're going to move into the – maybe we're going to take a three-minute break, David. We're going to take a three-minute break.
Okay.
How about that?
I know, Scott, you've got your hand up. Do you have a question for Bruce? Your mic's on mute.
You were talking about the problems with school, but I'm not clear what you see to be the alternative, or maybe there isn't one. You mentioned homeschooling. It wasn't clear whether you were saying that that's what the alternative should be, because I have some views on that, but just if you could expand on that.
Thank you. Yeah, and just really just for a minute, and then in my chapter on school, I go into greater depth about the need for children to be not locked up in school, to be given the chance to make as many decisions as possible. That's developing the muscle of their mind, the way Casey demonstrated in a lot of ways that he handled his students. But then I do a nice, short, but deep dive into the value of that kind of free-range life so that they can discover, fall in love with life. If they don't handle life, you can't fall in love with what you don't handle. And by being trapped in a building, they're not interacting with life. It's driving them into this, into the cell phone, into the digital capture. That's the goal and the intent of our overlords. And the solutions, Scott, are freedom so you can handle life, so you can have a chance to fall in love with it. Reading and writing, like I did put on the slides. Read your brains out. Children have to interact with minds that are more intelligent and more mature and more savvy in order for them to develop maturity and savviness and intelligence. And if you can't have that, you don't have adults around you to have those kind of conversations, read, interact with those minds. Do whatever it takes to develop the muscle of your mind, do whatever it takes to help the kids you care about develop the muscles of their discernment, their making decision ability. It's let them make decisions, and they will blossom as what they were meant to be.
Maybe one real quick question before that little wee 3-minute break.
Anybody else got a question?
Philosophically, I can understand what you're saying, but are you suggesting that somebody who's 70 years old would be able to make that decision of how they are educated or not educated? And, you know, a few minutes ago, you said that the interaction of different people is important, which I agree with, and that's something that one gets out of school. So are you saying we shouldn't have a school system at all, or I'm not really getting what the specifics are?
I don't know, Scott. I think these are specific suggestions to have kids be as free as possible, to expose them or allow them to be in situations where they have to make decisions consistent with their safety, because a 7-year-old needs adult supervision, needs parental supervision, needs loving supervision. They don't just need the supervision of a government caretaker. So it's the freedom so that they can learn to make decisions and also be interrogated along the way, along the lines of how Casey demonstrated, why do you think that? Why do you prefer this to that? And by asking them questions, and that's conversation. Because for millennia, thousands of years, humans developed just fine when they had freedom, could have conversations, and could also read the writings of intelligent people who talked about what those kids wanted to learn and honoring their sovereignty. It comes down to the last couple lines in the Star Spangled Banner, the land of the free, the home of the brave. To create kids who are free and brave, we need to set them free, consistent with their safety, and encourage them to have the bravery to figure things out for themselves.
I'm only pushing on it because, you know, it seems like increasingly people are not only willing to be stupid, but to be willfully ignorant, which is worse.
Well, we who are trying to be smart and who are trying to educate ourselves can do all that we can personally. And all of us here, you know, are here tonight to hear what one guy has to say about a book that he wrote. And to talk about these ideas, to encourage curiosity. Remember, one of the first things I said was, my life is reading interrupted. This is interrupting my reading right now. I'm not saying I'd rather be reading. So you're talking to someone who, by fate, by chance, by my intention before I was born, depending on how much you buy into my metaphysical scenario, is insatiably curious about the things that he's curious about naturally. But then I've recognized, because I absorbed it from other wise ones, you want to stay young? Stay curious. You want to learn? Ask questions. And if those could be inculcated, this is what's in my book. I want my book in the hands of everyone, Scott, who's dealing with the questions and the frustrations that you just described, the problem you just described of stupid and ignorant people. I want my book in their hands because it's intended to be a firecracker to get people off the bus from thinking the same kinds of thoughts over and over and over and over and over again. Not knowing, why am I thinking these thoughts? Why am I doing what I'm doing? Is it just because everybody's doing it? Is it because in school you were trained to just do what everybody else does, to not think for yourself, to not make decisions? You're talking to someone who's quite passionate about all the things you're talking about, Scott.
All right. Well, with that, let's go ahead and take a 3-minute break. So if anybody needs to get up and grab a drink, use the restroom, this is a good time for that. And we'll be right back. Everybody go ahead and just stay logged in, and if you want, you can turn your camera screen off.
I'm going to keep mine on and keep the sharing on and everything.
Okay, sounds great.
Okay. I'll be back.
Okay.
Hey, Dave.
Hey, what's going on, Larry?
Hey, brother. How's it going?
Oh, well, let's see. It's going pretty decent.
I've really advanced the blender model quite a bit. I already have the other side of Dealey Plaza done. You know,
oh, awesome.
Getting some really, really, really good images.
Will you be able to share that on our journey
Saturday.
Meeting we have on the 18th? Okay.
The 18th? Is it the 18th?
Yeah, the 18th. That's next Saturday.
Okay. Cool. Okay. Excellent.
Yeah, and for anybody that's still in the room here and is listening, we are going to have our next journey meeting, which is our monthly meeting that we do. It's going to be on December the 18th from 1 p.m. Central Standard Time until 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever the hell we finish up. That's usually how it goes. Yeah, definitely, Larry, if you can share those, I know that that'll be a great interest.
I need to talk to you, but, in private, if we can talk later on, over the phone.
Sure.
Nothing, just chat something. So, yeah, okay, yeah, we can do that, get some updated images, on the Blender project.
That sounds great, Larry. I appreciate that.
Hey, Larry, this is Casey. Can you hear me?
Hey, Casey, brother. How you doing?
I saw a couple of the images that you sent. That's fantastic. Let me throw something out real quick.
Oh, they're getting better. They're getting better.
Oh, they
they're
are. They're
better
so
by
bad.
The day. Yeah.
The three men who were standing on the steps, one of them is Emmett Hudson.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. He was the groundskeeper.
Right. The person in front in red. Okay.
Yeah. Who's that?
Well, that's the problem. We have about four or five names, and we don't have an actual name for that.
And look, one of them tore out. It went all the way into the foliage doesn't let you because of the shadow. He disappears. But he was running. At a good speed.
Is there any way that you could look at the person in red, his viewpoint on what he sees, and how far he might be from JFK.
Yeah, sure.
I have
a camera on Emmett. I can give you the one Emmett's view, or I can just push the camera up the steps, wherever you want.
Yeah, there's a reason for that, and I'll let you know later on. But I'll give this back to Bruce. But it's good talking to you.
Yeah, got it. Okay. I'm going to mute.
All right. Thanks, Larry. All right. Well, Bruce, you ready to go again?
Yes, I am.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and pick back up with the next section then. Go ahead, Bruce.
This is the next section. 9/11, JFK. Walt Whitman. I am the masked fireman with breastbone broken. Tumbling walls buried me in their debris. Heat and smoke I inspired. I heard the yelling shouts of my comrades. I heard the distant click of their picks and shovels. They have cleared the beams away. They tenderly lift me forth. In my chapter, I thoroughly list, and then in the back, there are tons of sources for all that is wrong with the official story of 9/11. How the planes were probably remote controlled into the buildings, how the towers were demolished by explosions coming from top to bottom, creating the illusion of descent
There were no stacks of floors at the bottom, like the official story says. The emperor has no clothes when it comes to this story. The thing that hit the Pentagon and knocked down those light poles came in the path with red at the bottom, past this, on that side of the Citgo station. Well, cops at the Citgo station saw a plane pass from the other direction and go at the time of the explosion simultaneously. So something came in the red line, probably a missile, could have easily had enough wings for balance and painted like a plane, because people saw a plane hit the building. But there are witnesses who have another plane that came in from the other direction. That blue line that from that other direction goes to, I think it's Reagan National Airport now. So some of the stuff that stinks about the Pentagon version, up top is Shanksville, where that's the smoldering hole. There's very few, there were next to no plane parts there. And then, of course, Building 7, the third building that came down that day, 5:20 in the afternoon. That's many people call the smoking gun of 9/11, because just some, you know, random fires in the lower floors. And then the films, lay people see that building come down in free fall speed and know that that's not structural damage. I talk about these goons, these liars. And then a nice dive into Al-Qaeda. Now, it was created by Western intelligence money, CIA money, combined with Pakistan's intelligence, which very much was a partner, if not puppet, of the CIA. And in 2006, someone asked the FBI officially, on your rap sheet for Osama bin Laden, how come 9/11 isn't on the crimes that you want him for? And the official FBI response was something like, because we don't have enough evidence to charge him with that. And as late as 2006, that was. I describe how President W. Bush stalled having an investigation for 14 months until overwhelming pressure caused him to authorize an investigation. And now he and Cheney circumscribed its parameters, what they could look at, the amount of the budget that they would have. They wouldn't testify under oath. They wouldn't testify publicly. No recording could be made of their joint conversation with the investigators. Only written notes could be taken. Just unbelievable. And there's a nice tangent in this chapter, my 9/11 chapter, about the CIA. It's origins, its infiltration of America. The Central Intelligence Agency is a breakaway force with, this is not mainstream knowledge, with enormous military and financial resources of its own. It has infiltrated and influences, if not controls, major institutions of power, and it owns hundreds of companies and false fronts here and around the world. Owns or created. It owns and or has created hundreds of companies and false fronts, charities, non-governmental organizations, think tanks. It owns and controls hundreds of them here and around the world. It has worked with our media since the 1950s through a program called Operation Mockingbird. It has worked with organized crime. It recruits and promotes young people into high positions of power in business, the media, the military, and politics. There's a lot of evidence and a lot of books by a lot of researchers these days about how after, well, Bill Clinton, Obama and lower politicians, senators, congressmen, representatives, and down into the local level have some way were groomed educationally or militarily through programs touching, connected to, intertwined with the CIA. And you could argue, and many people do, that the Clintons and Obama were such young, groomed folks who would be captured by the CIA and its agenda. It is impossible to quantify or underestimate the extent of its reach. It compartmentalizes and hides much of what it does so it can deny it. The vast majority of its people might not know much about its dirty deeds. Who knows up in the leadership that don't know the amazing, nefarious things that the CIA is involved with? One of the things was its mind control program from the 1950s, MK Ultra. This documentary by Aaron and Melissa Dykes shows how, in the MK Ultra programs, innocent people were strapped in beds for days, weeks, sometimes months, drugged, sometimes had electrodes put into their brains to burn and destroy parts with high-frequency microwave radiation, wiping out memories and identities, changing them forever, making certain feelings, thoughts, and behavior thereafter impossible. Dr. Peter Breggin exposed many of these atrocities. His biography calls him the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful efforts to reform the mental health field, in particular his work to raise awareness of the over-medication of children. One of the goals of MKUltra was to create Manchurian candidates, people who can and will kill on command, but not remember the deed nor the programming that induced it. The Manchurian Candidate is the name of a 1959 novel by Richard Condon about such mind control. It has been made into two movies so far. And these are arguably, if not proven in some of these cases, to have been hypnotized and steered into position. Top left is Charles Whitman, who mounted the tower at the University of Texas at Austin, I believe, in 1966 and started blasting away, and he shot about 20 people and about 15 of them died, and then he was killed in gunfire by police who finally were able to storm up to the elevated position that he was in. And he journaled, "I'm losing control of my mind and my emotions." And he was an ex-Marine. He was a young man in Texas. This is 3 years after Oswald was accused of killing President Kennedy, an ex-Marine young man in Texas shooting from an elevated position. And by 1966, so much truth was coming out about the Kennedy assassination that I ask, was Whitman played into doing these things in order to show the world, see, young ex-Marines in Texas do suddenly open fire for no reason. Lower left, Sirhan Sirhan, the man who was convicted for killing Robert F. Kennedy, when any examination of that case and its evidence completely calls into question his guilt, meaning persuades one that he was hypnotized to fire with a pistol that very likely had blanks in front of Senator Robert Kennedy to draw the attention away from the man shooting at Bobby Kennedy from behind him 1 inch away. And this poor guy is up for parole right now. I don't know the latest news, but he's been approved for parole in California. He's 70 million years old, almost 80 years old, I think. And the governor has to sign off on it or say, no, keep him in jail. Top senator John Lennon signing an autograph for Mark David Chapman, who also was arrested at the scene and also has extenuating circumstances around him. The doorman at the building was Jose Perdomo, who was part of Operation 40, the CIA's Cuban exile assassination group. Some of the evidence thinking that John Lennon was intentionally assassinated by either Chapman or Perdomo. Chapman did have a gun. George Herbert Walker Bush Sr., member of Skull and Bones. His family was close with the Hinckley family. There's John Hinckley, who was arrested for putting a bullet into Ronald Reagan. So Bush Sr. almost became president in 1981. All that looks like, stinks of, has indications of. This is what they can do with mind control candidates. Back to 9/11. We're going to talk about the enormity of 9/11 in terms of its impact on America and the trajectory of our story. Since 9/11, around 1.3 million Afghans, Iraqis, and Pakistanis have been killed in the war on terror, according to the source. 65 million people were displaced in 2017, according to that source, about half of them in or from Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Somalia, all countries we had invaded or attacked. Over 4 million refugees came into Europe to flee the chaos of our wars in the Middle East. Their presence is blamed for the expansion of police power and the violation of civil liberties. Around 6,000 American military veterans kill themselves every year, according to the Department of Veteran Affairs, and that seems to have been happening since around 2005. That would be 90,000 sons, daughters, brothers, sisters, fathers, and mothers over 15 years. Others say that 22 veterans kill themselves a day, or 8,000 a year, 120,000 over 15 years. Why do they do it? Because they realize that they were invaders, wrongdoers, killing, wounding, and displacing innocent people. On December 9, 2019, the Washington Post published the Afghanistan Papers, a secret history of the war, telling how the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were toppled by early 2002, within months of September 11th, after which we stayed and killed Afghans apparently because we wanted to. $1 trillion American dollars has created bad government and services that keep Afghans in misery over there. And yet, month after month, year after year, officials in the Bush, Obama, and Trump administrations manipulated data and lied to say that progress was being made. Our soldiers killed, suffered, and died for lies. A blacker betrayal, screaming for recognition and remedy, cannot be imagined. Thanks to 9/11, after the Department of Homeland Security and the USA Patriot Act and all that surveillance, a generation of Americans has never known privacy, anonymity, or peace. It will be hard for them to want what they have never known. The hammer came down with 9/11. The USA Patriot Act and the Department of Homeland Security is the cherry on the cake. It's fun to tell a story with a beginning, middle, and end. Act 1, 2, 3, if you will. At the end of Act 1, there's a plot point. At the end of Act 2, there's a plot point. The climax of the story, which sets up all the characters for the denouement, the descent into how does it end? You don't want it to end until it really, really ends. That's the suspense of a story. For instance, in The Wizard of Oz, in Act 1, over on the left, the hero, Dorothy, meets the nemesis, the teacher. The tornado throws the story in a completely different direction. What it was is no more. And our hero comes into direct conflict with her nemesis and wins. She douses her with water, she melts. And then at the end, Dorothy discovers, oh, she had the way to get home all along. She gets home. How does America begin, middle, and end? In 1832, Skull and Bones was established at Yale University, a secret society that stands for all the groups that secretly plot and conspire behind the scenes to inflict on us what they want to for their benefit. These are the richest of the rich, the psycho of the psycho, who want control over the vast herd, who consider us useless eaters, who think that they're much, much better and smarter than we. The plot point that completely changed America, which was pretty balanced between federal and state power, was a civil war. And it was the assassination of President Lincoln, which was a body blow. It was the killing of the king. It was psychological damage of epic proportions. And it was a ginned up conflict. In my book, I show the influence of the European money, exemplified by the Rothschilds, to bring on this war in order to control both sides, doesn't matter who wins, in order to control our enormous wealth that was growing and all of our resources. And the federal government ballooned. and it never came back. Lincoln said a lot like, hey, you know, a lot of this stuff might be rescinded. His expansion of powers to fight the war, he said a few things that indicated like he might have brought the balance back. Uh-uh. Federal government. In Act Two, we had the slaughter of the natives. We had corporations being decreed people, the rights of human beings. And we had the robber barons and the inauguration of the Federal Reserve, control of the money supply, and the phony manufactured war known as World War I, so people can make money and control populations, and Wall Street funding the Bolshevik Party turned into the communists, getting the Soviet Union up on its feet, funding the Nazi Party, getting Nazi Germany up on its feet, and using that war as, oh, see, we need a world organizing. And President Kennedy came toe-to-toe with these forces, standing for the ideals of freedom, and they took him out. And we descended to 9/11. The presidents after Kennedy were puppets and pawns of the powers. He was the high water mark of America. And with the Department of Homeland Security and the Patriot Act, the boot has been on our face ever since. America doesn't exist anymore. America is done. It's gone. It's over. Because you have to live under the Constitution and the Bill of Rights to call yourself America. And America is ours to create. It's up to us to cause enough people to move that big middle of the bell curve to want what Kennedy wanted, what I want, what I presumably everybody here wants. America, life under the Constitution again. We want our representatives to honor our rights under the Constitution and function inside the Constitution, honoring the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness for all human beings. That's what we want. This is America in three acts. This is America in one picture. From top to bottom, you kind of have 1, 2, 3, you know, beginning, middle, and end. Before COVID, I wrote this. This is in my book because my book was finalized just at the beginning of, you know the story. I told it earlier. But before COVID, after the years of whatever I had researched and had crunched into this book, I wrote, seeds of the world's crops are being collected and protected by the Crop Trust created by the UN as a hedge against disaster, they say. The UN and other powerful groups regularly discuss the benefits of a smaller world population and worldwide regulations and controls. Underground facilities and secret technology seem to exist. Military weapons, training, and vehicles have been acquired by state and local governments. FEMA camps have been prepared to accommodate thousands. At least one has hundreds of burial tubs. Walls along highways constantly being built might protect locals from the sound of traffic, but they might prevent escape from forced destinations. And this is really worth knowing and remembering. Ramping up to COVID, a record number of CEOs, over 1,300, resigned between January and November of 2019. Something unprecedented during a good economy. This is just before COVID was announced and COVID, you know, descended upon us. I wrote, our rulers seem to be preparing for something big. Maybe more than one or two questions, David.
Well, yeah, and I'd like to first make a comment. The 2019 Washington Post that you were talking about a while ago, the report on the Afghan papers, you want to talk about history repeating itself. And the Post was one of the ones that, you know, released the Pentagon papers back in the day. So, yeah, I happen to pick up on that. Just want to throw that comment out there that, yeah, it does seem like history repeats itself. But there is a question that was direct message to me. They're going to remain anonymous. But found it amazing and suspect when you look at the number of people on those flights. A flight from Boston to San Francisco in a jet that could hold 270 passengers has about 60. Same types of numbers with the other flights. Can you ask Bruce about this? So what do you say, Bruce?
Yeah, that's an amazing fact. And research finds a number of, I think, the mayor of San Francisco along these lines with foreknowledge. They were warned in the days and weeks getting close to 9/11 and sparsely populated planes are sure just another head scratcher that was not looked in deeply by the quote-unquote official investigation. History repeating itself. David, to your point, again, throwing back the recommendation, go to trineday.com, find the podcasts, look at the long list of about 70 episodes, pick a title that interests you, because Chris Milligan, my publisher, has been studying this stuff for 50 years. His father was in the CIA. His father told him in 1969, well, you know, the Vietnam War is all about drugs. There are these secret societies behind it all. Communism's all a sham. There are secret societies behind it all. The goal is to opiate your generation. They're playing out an intentional lose scenario. And history repeating itself, Chris goes on to explain. Every week he talks to one of his different authors like this, and they pull the taffy on, like, wow, how'd you get into that, and what's really going on? And even Kennedy's assassination followed by a war that would addict the generation to drugs, Chris says, was intentionally inflicted to model exactly what happened to Lincoln and what happened to the generation after the Civil War. All those wounded folks were addicted on painkillers, and that wiped out what would have been the civics generation, which removed the young men who would have defended the ideals of the founding, in my analysis, as we had for 80 years till that point, but they were flattened by the war. So you could have the lawyers and the rich people and the members of Skull and Bones who were throughout our institutions railroad through the laws and railroad, literally, no pun intended, the ascendance of the corporations and their phenomenal, gigantic, boondoggle, pork belly, wasteful exploitation of our tax dollars to grab their complete control of the government and our institutions, our social institutions and cultural institutions.
Hey, Bruce, this is Casey. I've got at least one question. Do you believe that the idea of COVID-19, do you believe that that might be a diversion or a false flag or both?
I'm going to be very tender. I'm going to answer your question, but I'm mindful of not violating YouTube's terms of sensitivity so that the video doesn't get taken down or your channel doesn't get deleted or anything like that. I have a chapter at the end of my book called COVID-19.
Right.
And I present the evidence that the official story is hogwash. And I speculate on and I give the evidence about what might really be going on. And I'm not going to say it in detail because I don't want this video or the channel to get spanked. But it is listed in what I say is a lie that is killing us.
Good point. And how about the JFK assassination? If you want to take it at another level, would you say that the assassination of JFK was a false flag, even though that he was murdered, but a diversion into moving into a new world order or continuation with the extreme wealthy and the corporations that are out there?
I'm going to give you Chris Milligan's answer. It was a magical act, he says. Magical in this, to the extent that it was the ritualistic killing of the king, which is an ancient royal thing. But it was definitely a false flag, strictly by definition, because it was self-inflicted and then blamed on a patsy. So they're wearing the false flag, wearing the false uniform of who's really doing it. It's self-inflicted, but blamed on others. So to that extent, it was a false flag. And I think, yeah, he's next. and like I said earlier, his assassination was the eyeball to eyeball, our high water mark, daring to try to confront the forces that were killing us. And these forces, killing him in one way was this very, very big event to traumatize us and decapitate us. But in another way of looking at it, it was just business as usual, because by the 1950s, the CIA began in 1947. By the 1950s, killing, assassinating, taking down, or subverting elected regimes was just business as usual for the CIA, and he was just another one. And Chris Milligan describes how he was a fatted calf. He was intentionally put it, brought in and allowed and to be as big and wonderful as he was, so that his murder would wound us all the more deeply. And it did. Look at what, look at how Gail was just fascinated by it, and this whole, your effort, your whole life, my whole life, because it's so wrong, and whatever is decent and good, it's such a night, it's just so wonderful to meet more people effing outraged 58 years later.
Hey, Bruce, got one for you here. This is another question that's an anonymous one, but you spoke about MK Ultra a while ago. Do you feel, or do you have an opinion, could Lee Harvey Oswald been a patient of MK Ultra and just not realize that, you know, he pulled the trigger, if, you know, you believe that variation, you know, pro-conspiracy, anti-conspiracy, do you think that he would have been, he could have possibly done it and then, you know, said, no, I'm just the patsy and I had nothing to do with it.
I don't believe he was hypnotized. I don't believe he fired a shot. I've never seen an ounce of, reading about his childhood, he was in some institutions as an orphan or as a truant for periods of time where it is possible he was interviewed or groomed a little along some MK Ultra protocols, but I've never seen that conclusion or accusation made. So that's what I think about him.
Okay, just question that got thrown out there. So, you know, I try to ask any questions that happen to pop up. Sometimes those are the anonymous ones that, you know, appear in my personal log here. But, yeah, I think, does anybody else have any other questions about the previous section? Scott, you got your hand up. Go ahead.
Yeah, since we have in common not only reading as a young person, but also an interest in film, I was going to suggest that the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers is really has a big part in the, what you're talking about. The idea of conformity and what happens if you don't conform is really seems to be a lot of what you're talking about to me.
Yeah, Scott, it's part of, and we have to love it. See, going back to the beginning, I am the intention to exist. I want it this lifetime. I am creating everything that I experience. I'm attracting it. These are the ideas that give me a lot of fun. To the point of the bell curve, most humans just go along with the most persuasive whatever. And the point in your question, our challenge, I submit, is to love humans and all we do. Humans in all of our nature, the fact that we are like that, that a decent percentage of us will just go along with what others go along the example of the movie that you gave, Scott. And I'm glad you had another question here, because if you didn't, I was about to ask you if in my other answer, did I seem like I was personally angry at you at all, Scott, because I assure you I wasn't.
No.
Good. Did I answer your question satisfactorily enough?
I'm not sure. What I mean by that is, what I was curious about on the original question was, were you talking about replacing formal education entirely? I wasn't quite clear where you were going on that. because I'll say for myself, even though I agree completely that most education is something that is done by the self, that the idea of having some kind of structure does help society, and I'm not sure that I would agree with completely getting rid of an educational system.
Well, starting with by looking at an ideal and working backwards, we don't have time to do that right now, because what I see in that model, if it was ideal for us to be on farms and in small, you know, villages and communities, coupled with this observation, John Taylor Gatto, the author I referenced earlier, career as a teacher in New York City, wrote books exposing the destruction and harm psychologically and otherwise caused by school, claimed it takes about 50 hours for a child to learn how to read and do basic math. 50 hours. What is 18 or 22 years of captivity needed for? Especially if we could somehow, but see, we're tied in this knot. Parents were taken into the corporate businesses as factory workers and now cubicle workers. So what do you do with the kids? It's perfect for the system, the controllers who took the Prussian model of society and schooling, which teaches its citizens, you serve the state. The state is God acting on earth. And we've got the Prussian model of education was inflicted on us by those good folks from Skull and Bones. What do you do with all the kids when they can't work with their parents? See, in nature, Scott, the ideal is nature. Animals raise their offspring. We're far from that because of our economic system. So, you know, let's grow up toward that solution. It's a huge opportunity to talk about it.
I would like to throw a comment here, Bruce, and I think Casey can back me up on this. I know that, I mean, I graduated in 93. I had Casey as a history teacher in 92. And I know that, you know, schools were definitely a lot different back in my day, compared to the way, I mean, I have three kids, one that just graduated high school last year and two more in public school. And unfortunately, because of teachers being bound by curriculum, and by what they can and cannot teach or what they can and cannot speak of, to teach our kids, it's up to parents and, you know, Casey being a former history teacher, you know, one of the things of why we do Project JFK, CSI Dallas and the website and these shows is to give the younger generation an opportunity to learn and to be able to ask questions that they can't ask in school. And it's usually resorted back to either it's not part of the curriculum, it's cover your own ass because I can't speak about this in school. So you're going to have to ask somebody else that's not part of the public education system.
Wow.
And it just seems like, you know, I don't want to say we're raising a generation of snowflakes, but, we're definitely dumbing down our generation. And by not teaching other than, you know, a small paragraph in a history book that, you know, the Warren Commission was correct in their finding that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone nut assassin. There is so much more. Obviously, there's so much more. 58 years later, we're still searching for the truth. And, you know, it takes things like what we do here and people that write books like you and, you know, can break it down into this because there's more to it than just what the kids are getting taught in school these days.
Yeah. And I contend that we don't learn what we're told. We learn what we do. And what Americans learn is to do nothing until they're told what to do. Because you look at the generations of Americans in the last 50, 60, 70 years where this has been kind of imposed. It explains the apathy, the political apathy. It explains the state that we're in. Where is the sufficient number of Americans outraged to do anything? If you're not allowed to fly until you're a full-blown adult, you don't desire to fly. You don't. If you're a bird and if you're a human through school to make decisions and think you have any power, if you can't make decisions, you're not exercising any power. So you don't think you've got the power to do anything. If you're not making decisions and learning by trial and error, you're not developing your judgment and trust in yourself. So the last thing you want is any responsibility. We're going to move on to the interest of time. And all good? Okay.
Yep. Let's go and move on to the next section.
Listen to this that I found by Whitman and thought, yeah, this is how I'm opening my JFK chapter. Vocalism, measure, concentration, determination, and the divine power to speak words. Are you full-lunged and limber-lipped from long trial, from vigorous practice, from physique? Do you move in these broad lands as broad as day? Come duly to the divine power to speak words. For only at last, after many years, after chastity, friendship, procreation, prudence, and nakedness, after treading ground and breasting river and lake, after a loosened throat, after absorbing eras, temperaments, races, after knowledge, freedom, crimes, after complete faith, after clarifyings, elevations, and removing obstructions, after these and more, it is just possible there comes to a man, a woman, the divine power to speak words. Then, toward that man or that woman, swiftly hasten all, none refuse, all attend, armies, ships, antiquities, libraries, paintings, machines, cities, hate, despair, amity, pain, theft, murder, aspiration, form in close ranks. They debouch as they are wanted to march obediently through the mouth of that man or that woman. People who lived through the Kennedy era say, what a waste. What a shame. I thought he was terrific. I thought he was going to change everything. The country's never been the same. High watermark of America's story. Efficient. Smart. His analysis of what's going on, therefore, what should we do, did the work for him. Because when you want to win somebody over, get their vote, win high office, you got to tell them the truth. It's got to be real. It's got to be real every way they look at it and evaluate it. And he was bringing not only America behind him, but the world. Wanting, inspiring more and more Americans to want to fulfill the ideals of the founding, which he taught, and leading the world toward the ideals of the founding, which he spoke. Life, liberty, the consent of the governed, the end of war. Let's enjoy life. We're all one people on one small planet. Eisenhower warned us 3 days before Kennedy took office. The forces that Eisenhower warned us about killed Kennedy on November 22nd. The military-industrial complex, a technological elite that was threatening to capture policy for a federal grant for scientific research would replace curiosity, plus overspending beyond our means and mortgaging our children's future so we would become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow. These forces killed Kennedy on November 22nd, 63, and studying his assassination reveals that the CIA adopted, soon after its creation in 1947, the policy of plausible deniability, the idea that it can commit crimes as long as America's role in them can be denied, especially by the president. That corruption
spread to the institutions with which the CIA worked, which were and remain the most powerful in the world. In 1959, labor leader Jimmy Hoffa brokered a deal between the CIA and some mobsters so they, working together, could assassinate Fidel Castro in Cuba, which is what the CIA wanted. By September 1960, Vice President Richard Nixon caused the CIA to work with other mobsters in new plots against Castro, whose elimination, Nixon hoped, would help him win the presidential election in November. The plan to kill Kennedy grew inside those CIA mafia plots. The truth, this is, Gail, this is for you. The truth about Kennedy's assassination reveals his greatness. He did what was right, what was good for humanity, for freedom, here in America and around the world where our influence will spread, knowing he was fighting forces that kill to win. His greatness inspires us to attain the same greatness by doing the same thing, standing for these things, and having the courage to say, give me liberty or give me death. Now you're an American. And these are my sources for the Kennedy chapter. Gail, what an obsession, what an inspiration. I numbered them, 225. This is just some of the stuff that I looked at and read. This isn't all of it. Obviously, there's pages in between here. Casey saw this when he read this. He said, Bruce, I think I've read all these books. I said, no doubt. And this, this is my audio library. Through the years, as I was studying him, I started downloading his speeches. Well, they led to his press conferences. Okay, well, then they led to all his campaign appearances, well, a lot of them. Well, then they led to the music of the era, and then it led to things before his presidency. And I listened to these over and over and over and over because I couldn't get enough of how real he was, of how persuasive he was, how recent he was, how smart he was. And it just goes on and on and on. So this is just all of his press conferences, 64. Since 2013, this is what my default entertainment. All this is on my phone. I'm ready to host a JFK radio show. I'm like, I'm your DJ, just name a month and a year. Boom, I'll play it. Sometimes I listen to his press conferences so frequently in a row that I realized you could blindfold me. You could say, pick a random answer that he gave from any question at any one of his press conferences, and I would try to finish the press conference from memory. Maybe not that extreme. I put them all into CDs so I could listen to them in the car. 98 CDs from beginning to end, and it starts back at the Roosevelt administration. With FDR and some of the songs. So over and 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 over again. This is me after I wrote my book. This is what I felt like by the time it got published. But I've showered and shaved, and I'm ready to, bring it to the world. In my chapter, I review Joseph Kennedy, his father, what a tremendous influence that he was. For good and bad in some ways, definitely the American dream, definitely a can-do guy, a guy who didn't take no for an answer, and a guy who had a lot of charm. And Kennedy absorbed that because he wasn't a bully, and he was sick, very young, and had to contemplate his own mortality throughout his life. And that gave him an edge. And he confronted death again in the Navy, and even though he was sick, he was frail, he got onto a bouncing PT boat, and his ordeal, which he overcame and helped his men overcome by courage and stamina, bravery, and also endurance, propelled him into politics with a lot of help from his father and his father's money. He became a congressman in 1946. And I do a deep dive into all these things, and I thoroughly, explain, these things really, really, really well. This is the biggest chapter in my book,
And there's nothing like a human example to fire anybody up, and he certainly did that for me. I tell his whole story in this chapter, how he became a senator, how he appreciated and hired Ted Sorensen and the great work that they created together and the great words and the great ideas, the great values that they had, more encounters with death, and then how by the late 1950s, he was able to earn the nomination by every day going out and campaigning. Because he had his own money, his father's money, he didn't have to play inside the system. He could ignore all the old timers who said, wait, it's not your turn, you're young. But because his health was so bad and he didn't know if he'd be walking next month or if he'd be alive next year because of his bad health, he pursued it so young. And I review his administration, 1961, this year of disasters, as President Kennedy called it. His discovery that the CIA and the Pentagon would lie to him to start a war over the Bay of Pigs in Cuba that easily could have escalated into a planet-destroying nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union. How he could sleep at night, maintain his composure, get back on the horse of looking and sounding good and being in command and control after the Bay of Pigs boggles the mind, boggles my mind. And he knew what he was selling. He was selling life, peace, the end of this confrontation, knowing that Dulles and Lemnitzer represented men and forces that wanted the biggest military and wanted confrontation in order to make the money from it and also dominate the world, exactly as the United States was accusing the Soviet Union of wanting to dominate the world. Lease the peace in a lie too big to fail. I think the quote is later. If it's not there later, I'll say it later. It says that the Kennedy brothers wanted to end the Cold War, which was nothing more than an excuse to pillage the resources of the underdeveloped world, and the Kennedys wanted something nice for everybody. 1962, again, we come to the brink over the Cuban Missile Crisis. This young Soviet officer was on a submarine around the waters of Cuba. They thought they were being attacked by America, and two of the officers wanted to use the nuclear missiles they had on their submarine, which would have blown up caused the blow up of the world. And this one guy, I think his name is Vasily Alexandrovich Arkhipov, said, no, we're not going to use our nuclear weapons. And we might be having this conversation because he did that. 1963, peace. He declared the end of war and the end of armaments is in our best interests. And his stand for civil rights, he knew this might cost me re-election in 64. He was ahead of, perhaps, he was gambling. But no, I'm going to take at least half the electorate with me. Obviously, he was gambling that. And the document at the right, he was going to pull out of Vietnam. Yeah, he put people in there at the end of 61. One could argue it was to shut the Pentagon up, throw them a bone, also shut Khrushchev up, because by the end of 61, Khrushchev had restarted nuclear testing and was, and so maybe that's why he put those guys in there. But he said to people, Kennedy, all around him, you evaluated it carefully for the first couple of years, but by 63, he was saying, I'm not sending ground troops into Vietnam. In my chapter, I do a nice analysis of the Zapruder film, where it might be tampered with, but what we can see, and I count up all the bullets, I think I get up to 11 or 12 shots, not that you can see in the Zapruder, but in the while the shooting was happening, what the Secret Service did and didn't do. Hats off to Vince Palomara and his amazing work on the Secret Service, and also what happened at the autopsy, and hats off to William Matson Law in The Eye of History and his other book, and Doug Horn and the ARRB, and what has come out about the shenanigans, the circus that was the autopsy that night, and what we got afterwards. These puppets and pawns. Liberty is in red because it's not in my book, because I've since learned by conversation with Chris Milligan, trying to interview with Philip Nelson, that in 1967, I think it was 67, Johnson had arranged for Israel to attack our ship, the Liberty, because they were going to blame it on Egypt. And Johnson had bombers on the way there with nuclear bombs, and he was going to use a nuclear weapon on Cairo. But the logistics of the shooting and how the Navy operated it got exposed and pulled back. Johnson is our poster boy for psychopathic lunatic. And I tell a lot of stories in my chapter about him. Nixon delayed the end of the Vietnam War, or helped delay it. Shenanigans, communicating to South Vietnam, treason. I described Watergate to the best of my ability and the factors that were going on there. How that seems to have been another coup by military and intelligence to get Nixon out, because he was too independent of a president for all of his other awful qualities. Carter's in red because in my book, I evaluate fairly what he did that was benign, if not helpful, but I've since learned how he let Brzezinski goad the Soviet Union into entering Afghanistan so that America and Carter could portray it as an invasion, the greatest threat to peace since World War II, to justify the end of the peace movement, which had begun in the 60s against Vietnam, and justify the completely unnecessary extension of the Cold War. Kennedy wanted to end it in 64, 65. And another enormous unnecessary buildup of our military. And I described the House Select Committee on Assassinations in the 70s and their recommendations to the Justice Department that they look into it, and how the Justice Department a few years later in 81 or 83 said, no, there was no second shooter. And then in 88, a little memo came out from the Justice Department. Nope, we don't see, against the recommendations, we don't see a need to reinvestigate either Kennedy's or Martin Luther King's. I have that whole history in there. I have a nice info about Bush Sr., Skull and Bones, and again, revisiting a little bit about the Reagan assassination attempt and President Clinton and what he enabled and allowed during his presidency. There, of course, is the slaughter of Americans without due process at Waco, Texas, and the bombing of Oklahoma City, which has lots to indicate that the official story of that is also a lie that is literally killed people and still being told today. And again, into 9/11, the end of America with the USA Patriot Act. Kennedy was human, with his share of strengths and weaknesses, courage and cowardice, clarity and blind spots. And he and Khrushchev saved the world from the consequences of their actions, with mighty forces pushing them to the brink. But they saved it. Jesus supposedly saved the world. We number the years from his birth as tribute. If we numbered the years from the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, 2021 would be the year 59. We might remember how recently we almost went extinct. We might stop flooding the world with weapons. We might see, since our military is stronger than the rest of the world combined, and most countries are friends or trading partners, and the rest could be made friends if we respected their rights and sovereignty, we might see that our gigantic military serves two purposes: to enrich its owners and enforce their will in the world. In A Lie Too Big to Fail by Lisa Pete, in A Lie Too Big to Fail, typo. Lisa P. said, the Cold War was a cover for plundering the world's resources from poorer nations. The Kennedy brothers wanted to make the world a better place. They made enemies of those who run our economy, media, and covert ops. But as Kennedy said, it is better to light a candle than curse the darkness. The internet in late 2020, when I was finalizing my book, still lets us find and share truth at a revolutionary pace. Enough noncompliance and insistence might stop our war machine and restore our rights. On Martin Luther King Jr. Day in January 2029, the Truth and Reconciliation Committee announced its existence by asking Congress to reinvestigate the assassinations of JFK, Malcolm X, Dr. King, and Robert F. Kennedy. It includes members of the King family, Robert Kennedy's family, historians, journalists, lawyers, and experts of those cases. If ongoing, when you read this, add your strength to it. To reconcile, we must forgive. Then we can look not at each other, but forward, together, toward a future we can trust, because it will be built on the truth. John Lennon said, when it gets down to having to use violence, then you are playing the system's game. The establishment will irritate you, pull your beard, flick your face to make you fight. Because once they've got you violent, then they know how to handle you. The only thing they don't know how to handle is nonviolence and humor. When he became president, Kennedy began his inaugural address by saying, the same revolutionary beliefs for which our forebears fought are still at issue around the globe. The belief that the rights of man come not from the generosity of the state, but from the hand of God. We dare not forget today that we are the heirs of that first revolution. And then he said, let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike, that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans, born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage, and unwilling to witness or permit the slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed, and to which they are committed today, and to which we are committed today at home and around the world. He stood for the freedom and dignity of man. To do likewise is to use his memory for all it's worth. David, who has the first question?
All right, who's got a question for Bruce? Go ahead, Gail.
So is that Truth and Reconciliation Committee still ongoing?
To my knowledge, it is.
That's really great news. I didn't even know about that. That gives me some hope, because that, to me, we're never going to actually know definitively what happened, and it's only through Truth and Reconciliation process that we're going to come to a consciousness of understanding that will allow us to move forward and see how all of this is an evolution of evil that has just grown over time.
Yeah.
I just wanted to also ask you whether you feel that Kennedy was well aware that what he was doing was going to result in his overthrow or death. I think he had a sense of that, don't you?
Oh, I'm convinced it's kind of documented, Gail. It's kind of documented, and I refer to the documentation in my chapter.
Then why didn't he take any effort to protect himself more?
One must assume he was convinced he took enough, that he was taking enough, and that he believed the threat assessments that he was getting. One has to assume that. But even so, the whole course of his administration was like an ice cutter into the threat. It would be great. I would love to ask him, was your whole administration, how much did you feel throughout your presidency that you were on a kamikaze suicide mission? It's easy to imagine for him to know. Even Bobby Kennedy said after the president was shot, I thought they were going to get one of us. I thought it was going to be me. The mind boggles. In one of my talks I gave at that open mic, I said, I can scarcely comprehend courage like that.
Hmm. Yeah.
And that's why in my previous presentation for Casey and David and Brian here at Project JFK, first chunk of it is exploring, speculating on Kennedy's thoughts and beliefs about death. And like a much older person, he was resigned to it. I'm getting to the point where I'm at my age, we're like, yeah, I'm pretty resigned to it. I'd like to have a number of decades, but I'm pretty resigned to it. Once you're this age, at his age, to be that resigned to it is why at 40 something, he exudes the wisdom of someone at the end of his life.
Yeah.
The grandfather or grandmother that you love to sit with and absorb, how do they think and feel about things?
When you're not afraid of death, it frees you up to be your true self.
You know, Bruce, this is Casey again. I wanted to point out to you, and I probably don't have to because you pointed it out to us so magnificently, Kennedy's words, and you tie those in with the other chapters that you brought up. But his words, boy, I tell you, just hearing you say those again, where have we gone with the politicians that we have now? I mean, my God, those words are extremely powerful, but where are they today?
We don't need them because we're not illiterate. We're not as literate of a nation. And it goes back to Sorensen and Kennedy's study of what made Lincoln great, what made the Gettysburg Address great. It goes back to Kennedy and the family's obsession with what's excellence? How can I be the best I can be? How can my work be the highest quality in the amount of time anybody has to do anything? It's such a race. Those are the two factors put into it. And Lincoln's clarity of thinking. When I read Lincoln, it's fun to see, oh, this is where Kennedy or Sorensen got that logical arrangement. And then when I read the Federalist Papers and Hamilton's writing, I think, oh, this is where Lincoln got that logical arrangement and comparison and listing of overwhelming evidence to persuade someone to your point and the light touch. And so it comes down to literacy. It comes down to swallow the dictionary, I say in the point, quoting an article Charlotte Thompson Isherby quotes of a study that says Americans are getting dumber through the years. And this was written in 1971. Because we know less words because of aptitude tests. Swallow the dictionary. And George Orwell. Yeah, Casey, that's why we don't need a president to put more than the words together that they have recently, because we have been intentionally distracted and prevented from becoming literate people, which means reading and writing. That's the definition of literacy. Not just reading. It's reading and writing.
The respect aspect of this, one thing that always struck me about the Kennedys is that they never talked down to people. And they talked about, they quoted Greek philosophers to anybody. And
Bobby came to mind when you said that, yeah.
one of the most tragic and one of the most beautiful things I ever saw in my life is when Robert Kennedy talked about the death of Martin Luther King. And he quotes the Greek philosopher, and I'm thinking, here he's talking about this thing that this violent aspect that's happened that's affecting African Americans, and most people are going to talk down to them. And here they're talking up, he's talking up to them. And that's what made them great. It's, yes. It's something that it's amazing to think about now where people want to be willfully ignorant.
Well, it also comes down to the Kennedys had FU money, okay? They didn't have to pander to anyone from money sources for their candidacies. So they could call it like it was, and they really were authentically trying to make change, and also they had the confidence to speak from what they knew. For instance, they had those educations, Bobby and Jack, you know, they had the Harvard educations, and they had the confidence and the security in themselves, because to talk from what they knew and what was inside them without caring if it may alienate anybody. Insecure people can't do that. Corrupted people can't do that. So right there, that's described our modern quote unquote politicians who for all intents and purposes, not every single one, but for the ones that matter, to some extent are captured. And they are serving agendas that have nothing to do with the truth of what would make us healthy or what would make us free. Who's got the next question? David, I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
How hard and fast is our designated end time?
It's not really, we've got it scheduled for 6 to 9, but we can go longer, no problem.
Woohoo! Then with that, we shall.
Okay, let's move on to the next question.
We were talking about the lies that are killing us, and now we just did 9/11 and JFK, and I've got a brief history of the United States from beginning up till modern times. The illness that can't be named, and something called check, please. The lies that kill you, and the truth that sets us free. Brief history from Uncle Tom's Cabin, Harriet Beecher Stowe, liberty, electric word. Why, men and women of America, does your heart's blood thrill at that word, for which your fathers bled, and your braver mothers were willing that their noblest and best should die? Is there anything in it glorious and dear for a nation that is not also glorious and dear for a man? What is freedom to a nation but freedom to the individuals in it? This is how Americans thought and spoke and stood on for the first many generations. It transformed after the Civil War. It did slowly, because we still couldn't be bombarded by alternate brainwashing. That really kicked in with radio and television and movies and everything since, you know? This is a picture I drew inspired by Harriet of one woman just helping another woman off her feet. I didn't submit it for the last final version of the book. I kind of wish I did. There's a handful of others that'll, you know, not tonight, but they'll, you know, I have these things. Brief history of the United States. I cover the Declaration, the founding generation, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. I talk about the tension of slave owners and the tension between the fear of a general government and the Bill of Rights being supplied in order to get the ratification of enough of the states. With the American Revolution, just like I said earlier that Kennedy is America's high watermark, was America's high watermark, America is humanity's latest high watermark through the history we can chart. There's a lot of evidence and research that says way in the past, advanced civilizations came and fell just kind of like we're doing now, where cataclysmic abuse by the psychopathic lunatics who fell in love, got drunk with power. But in the history we can chart, America is the high watermark of humanity. With the American Revolution, white men of the masses assumed, not royalty, not noble blood, just regular white people, white men of the masses assumed more freedom and political power than they had ever had before. Some northern states saw the wrong of slavery in light of the revolution's ideals and passed laws to help free slaves and put slavery on a course to extinction. Many people in the South, as well as the North, freed their slaves. As women and minorities slowly attained the recognition of their rights, the slaughter of the natives and the development of the continent's resources eventually let the rich replace workers with technology, burden us with debt, and control us with fear, news, and entertainment. Because with technology, they don't need so many factory workers anymore. They don't need so many cubicle workers anymore. We would get restless unless they crippled us with fear, news, and addictions to entertainment, if not worse addictions. The new government, over time, made and broke treaties with Native Americans, pushed them west, and corralled them onto reservations. The new Constitution protected slavery in the states that chose to have it. A compromise with the states that wanted slavery eliminated everywhere. Slavery comes from nature. The strong eat the weak. Every race enslaves every race, even its own kind. Maybe especially its own kind, since they are most handy. The only thing that stops the strong from enslaving the weak is the concept of rights. Rights have been conceived in the West for about 1,000 years when America was founded. The so-called civilized nations of Europe were phasing out slavery as industries outgrew the need for it. Some of the American founders were hypocrites for espousing liberty while protecting slavery. But we are fools if we emphasize the slaveholding provisions of the original Constitution and the hypocrisy of the founders who held slaves over the ideals and rights they bequeathed us. Let us embrace the good, the concept of rights, and throw out only the bad, slavery and hypocrisy. Let us fulfill the ideals of the founding better than the founders. Let us abolish all that exploits and oppresses people and protect the rights of all. This is the foundational thing that we should stand on when it comes to modern swirling debates and arguments about the founders of the founding. Period. Come here. Moving these things around. The Second Amendment says, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Gun ownership is not about hunting. It is about protecting our state from the national government. We made a government, the general government, the federal government, that honors our right to arm itself against it. That is the most amazing, unprecedented American thing about us. That still stuns and stands unique in history. Previously, might made right. Here, rights would make might, and guns would let the historically oppressed, the physically and economically weak, protect themselves from those who could exploit them. If the American greeting, our namaste, can't be my rights honor your rights, it defaults to the gun in my hand honors the gun in yours, the recourse given us by the founders. When the delegates of the convention emerged with their constitution, Benjamin Franklin was asked, what kind of a government have you created for us, sir? A republic, he replied, if you can keep it. George Washington stunned the world by leaving the army after the war and not becoming a king. His presence at the Constitutional Convention was deemed essential to earn for its result the concurrence of the people. Many in Europe said he would never step down if he becomes president. He will cling to power and there will be fighting in the streets. He cheerfully went home after two terms. He could have been reelected indefinitely. In my chapter, I cover the First Bank of the United States and how Americans knew and the founders, half the founders, it was a battle, wanted to resist such a separate central bank. And Jefferson's praise of revolution from time to time, watering the tree of liberty, the blood of tyrants and patriots. The War of 1812 and the Rothschilds' apparent machinations and involvement as revenge against the First Bank of the United States possibly not being extended, how the Second Bank seemed to be made more necessary because of the debts run up by the War of 1812, Andrew Jackson's obstruction of the extension of the Second Bank. He didn't like it. He didn't want it. He was the first president. Pistols pointed at him. I think they both misfired. And I describe how in 1837, as currency and property values fell to 10% of previous worth, 21-year-old August Belmont arrived in New York from Germany. He had worked for the Rothschilds since he was 13. He bought devalued assets, got rich, and was active at the top levels of the Democratic Party when President James Polk launched a war against Mexico in 1846. Belmont bought the greater portion of America's bonds as a financial agent for the government. We beat Mexico and took land that became Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and California. In some New England states, attendance was made mandatory in some schools for the first time. Parents went to those schools, throttled those teachers, and took their children home. They knew that the loss of some freedom leads to the loss of it all. Since then, each generation has been raised more and more by school and less by parents. The idea that we belong to the state and that the state must provide opportunity has become mother's milk to many who have never heard otherwise. Bill Clinton, as president, said many times that government must give the people the tools with which to succeed. No thanks. I'll take freedom and make my own tools, no strings attached. Our rights and freedom are the only tools we need. Until we understand and insist on that, we are the United States of hypocrisy. We say we are free, yet tolerate near total control. We tell our children, you are free. Then we send them to school, where they're treated like prisoners, where they have to hold still and silent until told what to do. That's torture for children who are active by nature, who learn by satisfying curiosity. By preventing children from satisfying curiosity, school prevents them from learning. It kills their interest in life and their ability to learn. It makes them good little sheep who follow the leader, even when that leader is each other. They are trained to do what everyone does, what's normal, which is often to show no interest or enthusiasm for anything, to project boredom and contempt for everyone and everything. Governments and corporations are tools. Those who use them should be praised for the good they do and punished for the harm. They should not be allowed to limit their liability, act as vaccine manufacturers have since the 1980s. When we think of ourselves as resources who must do the work and use the tools given us by authority, up is down, left is right, the tail is wagging the dog, the dead are burying the living, the creature is killing the creator, and the joy of living is gone. History is the story of our struggle to identify and defend human sovereignty. No history, no sovereignty, no happiness, with a K. No history, no sovereignty, no happiness. Sovereignty and humanity are one. Honor one, you honor the other. Squelch one, you squelch the other. To treat people and animals humanely is to honor their sovereignty, their right to live and steer their own lives. This, remember, from the three-act structure, the Civil War was the change. This is the tornado in Dorothy's life. The old, she's lifted up and thrown into a whole new world.
The Civil War changed everything. It changed what America was. Didn't kill it. That's coming. It changed it. It changed it. There's evidence that Lincoln would have brought the balance back to a proper federal-state relationship under the Constitution. We'll never know. For all intents and purposes, slavery continued. The way that blacks were treated in America after the Civil War, on paper they were free, but it took 100 years of effort and agitation and sacrifice to treat these people like human beings. They were exploited by the economic forces and powers that created the war and won the war. Here they are, the robber barons. Rockefeller, Vanderbilt, Carnegie, Pierpont, Morgan. Morgan and Rockefeller were essentially, or some people argue, they're just extensions of the Rothschilds, if not, you know, full partners. It was a member of Skull and Bones as a judge who gave an opinion, a one-sentence opinion that corporations have the same rights as people. It wasn't an illegal opinion. It was in a comment of a case. And the ascendancy of the banking money corporate powers ever since, Lincoln even warned about them when, you know. And we pushed west. The railroads got subsidies. These are buffalo heads. Because the faster you could kill buffalo, the faster you could starve Indians. That was the plan. That was the intention. To lay that track and make the money, to get those government subsidies to lay the track. Didn't matter where it was going. Routes went up and down all over the place because of the political machinations of the representatives surrounding that land. And in my brief little history, I get us into the 20th century and how the Federal Reserve was the result of a conspiracy among the bankers. It's not a government institution. It's a private banking cartel. And there's a great movie. Is it America, Freedom to Fascism by Aaron Russo? Probably. That calls into question not only the constitutionality of the Federal Reserve Act, but also the federal income tax, and also in 1913. And I talk about how World War I was created by moneymakers and connivers and conspirators from Skull and Bones and that ilk that went into the, created the Council on Foreign Relations in 1921. Because the League of Nations was a non-starter, failed of creation in the United States. And how at that time, Harriman and the Bushes and many dozens, if not hundreds of American companies, but definitely these big Wall Street bankers, threw money, got money to the Bolsheviks in Russia and got money into the fledgling Nazi party and built up communism in the Soviet Union and built up the Nazis in Germany to do World War all over again. To make that money, and then the Wall Street crash and the Depression, and I evaluate FDR for good and bad. In case you could, you know, it's very little is all black or all white in this world, and how World War II was this another excuse for all that it gave the elites up in power. I review a little bit about the CIA and touch on JFK, just mention and get us up to speed with more about everything since, including these folks again, some of the CIA drug running, you know, and our latest recent Obama and Trump, and Barack Obama, his mother, father, stepfather, and grandmother were all connected to the CIA before anyone ever heard of him, according to investigative reporter Wayne Madsen. Was he groomed for the White House his whole life? Obama was given unprecedented amounts of corporate money and token opposition, McCain and Palin, in 2008. As president, he expanded war and police state policies. He vowed the reverse and signed the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012 that gave him the so-called right to imprison and kill people, including Americans, without due process, if in his sole discretion he declared them to be belligerents or suspected terrorists. That's the kind of power we rebelled against in 1775. Wayne Madsen, investigative journalist, author, and columnist, said in a September 2020 podcast with Prime Day publisher Chris Milligan and yours truly that former businessman and television celebrity Donald J. Trump was compromised in the 1970s by Czech intelligence, which was tied to the Soviet Union's intelligence service, the KGB, through his first wife, Ivana Zelnikova, whose father was a Czech intelligence informer. Madsen said that Trump is indebted to the mob for financial help received throughout his career. Moving my... Most Americans lived on farms and ate nutritious food in 1900, and cancer occurred at low rates. Now, most of us live in cities and towns. We eat chemicals called processed food, and one out of two of us, or one out of three, gets cancer. Nearly half. This is just before COVID. Nearly half of all Americans over the age of 12, 119 million people, over one-third of our population, take prescription pain relievers, tranquilizers, sedatives, or stimulants, according to a federal survey National Public Radio reported in September 2016. We are brainwashed to think we need pills. We are less than 5% of the world's population, but 45% of its $1.2 trillion pharmaceutical market. Health companies spend nearly $30 billion on medical marketing each year, and around 68%, or about $20 billion, goes to persuading doctors and other medical professionals, not consumers, of the benefits of prescription drugs, according to that source. 70 to 80% of advertising is paid by pharmaceutical companies. 70 to 80% of advertising by pharmaceutical companies. Drug companies spent $905 million on direct-to-consumer advertising in the first half of 1999 alone, a 43% increase over spending levels a year earlier, according to that source. I say we are sold petroleum-based drugs by a trillion-dollar arm of the petroleum chemical industry that makes the food and fertilizers that make us sick. One branch feeding the other with profitable patients, per the Monsanto Bayer example that was in the book earlier. Where am I? On January 8th, 2019, podcast, Dr. Zach Brown told wellness evangelist Rich Roll that one out of three American men are sterile. One out of four women are infertile. 46% of children have a chronic disease before they reach adulthood, the kind that adults used to get. One out of 36 children develop autism, a huge increase over the past 30 years that many link to the vaccines being given to children. At current rates, one out of five to one out of three children will develop autism not many years from now. The annual cost of managing chronic diseases is $3.5 trillion, and it grows annually between 6 and 8%. If things don't change, Dr. Bush assured Mr. Roll, healthcare will soon crush our country. He said in 2019, before COVID. The lies that are killing us indeed. This is the last slide before conversation. To make the lies that are killing us. And remember Rockefeller taking over education, oil taking over education and medical profession and medical education, selling this petrochemical assault and the state of health. Now, I think in the 1970s, it was one out of 1,000 or one out of 10,000 children got autism. Now it's up to this epidemic, catastrophic level. To make every level of government work for us, we must find and debate the truth without ceasing. To increase the number of critical thinkers who will demand accountability and responsiveness, all sides of every issue must be looked for and studied, especially now when we are in an age of censorship and demonization that really reminds a lot of people of Nazi Germany in the 1930s. No institution of power, nor any figurehead, can be trusted. Too many harm us for profit and control. We should evaluate everything that goes beyond the 10th Amendment, which is most of the federal government. keep the benefits of national citizenship, and throw out its harm. We should boycott the big corporate powers as much as possible. The 10th Amendment. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution to the federal government, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people. This is a suggestion of a foundational thing for us all to try to take to heart, try to start taking some action on, spreading the news about. And I love the first sentence, you know, we got to debate all these things primarily to develop the minds of the people we have conversations with, because we know we're dealing with so many of our dearly beloved fellow humans who just think, eh, what can you do about it, Brucey? You know, whatever, it is what it is. Who's got the first question?
All right, who's got the first question for Bruce?
Give it time, it's coming.
Let me look at the chat.
Like a little seed.
Boy, Bruce, this is Casey. I would say I wish I had the opportunity to teach again, because a lot of the resources and the words that you used were wholehearted, right to the point. And I think they have to be read to the class or read with the class. And if they don't understand, we'll go over what it actually means. But how you put it out was excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. And you just reminded me of how much I love to read. I called my life Reading Interrupted. I almost get scared imagining how I could possibly have survived life without reading, how I could possibly have developed my mind, how I could have possibly observed, been able to define, identify my raging chaotic emotions, which we all have unless you make them conscious or you have to anesthetize them in order to live with yourself. Thank you, Casey. What you said just reminded me of, I would love to teach anyone how to read. I would really, 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 to try to communicate some of the power, pleasure, and relief and fun that it is, has given me.
I'll throw in a comment real quick. Having spent my years in education in math and science and then my career in manufacturing, we learn a discipline. And I think the overarching theme that I'm kind of getting from everything that you presented tonight is the issue of control. And when you're a scientist, when you're a manufacturer, you've got a process. You have to have rules and structure and procedures that get followed, right? We want continuous improvement. We want zero defects. It's the striving for perfection. And you only get that when you really instill, you don't want free. I grew up in an educational realm totally the opposite of you, because you're an artist, okay? I'm on the other end of the spectrum. But it seems like the Achilles heel of all of that is you don't want free thinkers to a degree, right? You want people that hear the rules, hear the instructions, do what I say and obey. And that's actually, that was the Achilles heel of American manufacturing for a lot of decades, because they didn't listen to the people on the floor in the shop, the people that are actually doing the work, right?
But did you say, Brooks, that I want everyone to toe the line, follow the rules, and
No. I'm saying you're coming from a different discipline, having been an actor and an artist. And
I followed that, yeah.
Yeah. And so I think the challenge, and let's go back to tribal organizations and the herd mentality and whatnot. The most important instinct, I think, for all of us is survival, right? So we organize, we develop a structure, rules to obey, and a lot of it's all driven by, okay, we need to survive. Okay, we need to be able to hunt, to feed ourselves, to survive, protect ourselves from the enemy. So
you need those things to make that all work. Now, I'll give you a funny example. I was a little dismayed when as my son got older, that his room was constantly in a state of disarray. Let's just call it a near disaster, okay? And every once in a while, since it was the last door on the hall before I went downstairs, I would open it up and peek inside when he wasn't there just to see how it was. And so I called him upstairs one night, and I opened him up, and I explained the law of entropy to him, which he wasn't really prepared to hear, but I just thought it was a good analogy. And the law of entropy says, and it applies to natural gases, but it says, if you have a closed system and you exert no force on that system, the contents over time will go totally random. Okay, that's the law of entropy. So in order to keep us all marching in a certain direction, be it education or our civic leaders or whatnot, right? They're going to exert a force on us. They're going to impose rules and restrictions and vax mandates and masking and everything that you can possibly throw on the table. So my takeaway from this is you did a great job of really, although you didn't hit it over and over again, but I would say the C word. It's all about control. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're fighting against in terms of individual freedom and liberties, right? Our ability to think for ourselves. And as a former university trustee, I can tell you one of the things we grappled with the most was the absence of critical thinking. We're not producing graduates at the collegiate level and sending them out into the workplace and into the world with the ability to think for themselves. There is no critical thinking that's really stressed and developed. We're recognizing the shortfall, but it's a travesty.
Yeah, and if Dr. Bruce Lipton is right about our programs, our ways of being set by the time we're 7 years old, it's like that those habits are our habits unless we are stunned, have a trauma that causes us a midlife crisis. Why do I do what I do? That's the point where people are kind of born again. They wake up and can renew their minds and realize, I once was lost, but now I'm found. That's kind of how I describe I thought of Kennedy again with something you just said, to the praise of his father, how he raised them to think for themselves. His life is a blazing lesson just in that. And then everything else you said about control and the consent of, oh, Kennedy, don't fence me in, you know? Let me evaluate it. I'll make, you know, not his words, but the way he lived was, and maybe that's rich man's son modality that was natural to him, but you and I can adopt it, which is, I have the right to evaluate what you're proposing. And if I smell that you don't respect that and you want to C-word me, control me, I'm already gone. You know, who's next? Oh, David.
Yeah.
I don't see a thing saying recording. Do you?
Yeah, it's on my screen. The meeting's being recorded.
Thank you.
I do want to throw this out real quick. I know that we've been talking about where to go and pick up the book at. I noticed that it is out of it's sold out as of right now on Trine Day's website, but there are 20 copies available on Amazon, and you can also get the Kindle version there. So if anybody has not picked up Bruce's book, I don't know. Chris is pretty good about keeping books in stock. I don't know when it'll be available again on Trine Day's website, but if you haven't ordered it yet, you might want to switch over to Amazon after the event this evening and pick up a copy.
Definitely. And I don't know if it helps Chris, but, you know, instead of getting one copy, if you got 200 or 300, maybe that would help. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, give them out. Hey, Christmas is right around the corner. What are we, like 23 days away? They make excellent Christmas presents. So,
your words.
Absolutely. Anybody else have any questions for Bruce? Any comments? Do you have another section after this, Bruce?
Oh, heck yeah.
Okay. Just checking. All right, if we don't have any more comments, then we can switch over to the next one then.
The illness that shan't be named. In my chapter, you get to learn about Operation Lockstep, which is in 2010, about a scenario like this, and a little look at the good doctor, and also his 2017 speech, kind of guaranteeing what showed up in 2020 by way of illness. And also this thing called Event 21, which was a rehearsal or a practice or a preparation. You be the judge at the end of 2019 before everything hit the fan. You get to learn who Francis Boyle is, talking about the origin of the scary thing that's scaring everyone for the last couple of years. And a review of how come some numbers are tough to verify, you know. People who've got the thing, people who may have passed from the thing. I make the case that it's completely unknowable, that the numbers sold to us are not trustworthy. So whatever's going on, it takes personal research to get a feel for what's going on. It's not just what's being fire hosed at us. The efficacy of protocols, you know, the things we're being told to do have huge problems, huge dangers. And we are lucky enough to have another Kennedy on the scene, Bobby Jr. And I review what he was saying through 2020, and I advise all of us to check out what he's been saying all this year about this state of affairs. Really emulating his father and his uncle. Really, really, really putting it on the line. And like the president, like I've been saying all night, describing so much truth, laying out the evidence like such a good lawyer that me as the jury goes, wow, that makes sense to my layperson's understanding of medical situations and scientific processes and mindset and evaluation. He's hitting home runs. He talks about the billionaire from Microsoft and talks about the world. I talk about also the World Economic Forum and their plan for us, their plan for the world. In that chapter. Before that nasty illness, we worked long hours, many of us at two jobs, and we watched lies and nonsense until sleep overcame us at night. We bought permission to do practically everything through licenses, fees, and taxes. We might live under maritime law, represented by the gold fringe on American flags. And we might surrender our rights and reinforce our status as employees of the corporation that the United States might be when we sign things with our names in capital letters and agree to procedures in court that we don't understand. That's alluding to details in previous pages. But since this illness, was it a relief to stay home and do nothing? And avoid jobs that were the most boring part of our boring lives? Some Germans said that the Nazi years were the best years of their lives. They didn't have to think or make decisions. They felt free. That's the freedom of a slave. And those Germans committed atrocities under the spell of that absurdity, as Voltaire had foretold. Earlier in my book, you read Voltaire's quote, those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. And my last chapter is check, please. Please. Check for yourself. See for yourself. Because we live in opposite land. The Department of Defense doesn't prevent wars, it starts them. medical errors are the third leading cause of death in America. What we buy as the cure kills us. Opposite land. And it goes on and on and on. I have a nice stacked list. It's not all these main ones, you know, or the organized religion in America and school and the story about 9/11 and the story about JFK and all the other false flags are the opposite of reality, which is why we have to check for ourselves. Check, please. Please check. And I review what they believe, these elites. I'm missing a quotation mark there, what they believe. It has something to do with UFOs. It has something to do with Egypt. I talk about Egyptian symbols throughout America and the Masons and how throughout Europe and then into the United States, what that seems to signify, that there is this, there's evidence that these psychopathic lunatics, ticks, the elite at the top, have esoteric spiritual beliefs more or less around them being the descendants of a better alien race than we are, or they were the descendants of an alien race that came here and manipulated animals to make us as a slave race. I'm not saying any of that is true or false. I'm just saying there's tons of evidence to indicate that's what's inside their belief system, going back through Skull and Bones and the Masons and the Illuminati and then the Middle Ages. Jim Mars has a couple of great books about this. Rule by Secrecy. The subtitle is something like the connection between the pyramids and the Trilateral Commission. His other book is The Rise of the Fourth Reich, the secret societies that threaten to take over America, that show this. And then you see this, then he starts to explain all the pyramids and solo eyes and obelisks, the Washington Monument, the same thing in Dealey Plaza by a bed of water. Chris Milligan says Dealey Plaza is an outdoor Masonic temple, and that was a ritual sacrifice. The way the streets form, it's a pyramid flipped upside down. It's the trident, which is also, you know, the streets do this. It's fascinating to imagine that these psychopathic lunatics who are doing this to the world have these beliefs, but it doesn't matter. I say in my book, that's armchair stuff. That's weekend stuff. That's après-ski. That's fireplace. During the day, the evidence should bring into court. We should prosecute these psycho lunatics for the demonstrable crimes they've committed. Why they do it, that's a backstory that's of marginal interest. I talk about missing children, the millions that go missing around the planet each year, and what these psychos might be doing to them, other dimensional entities, and our need, how we must overcome fear and generate hope in order to face this stuff, which goes back to the beginning, which is Bruce saying, I do so well, and so many people do so well with a spiritual imagination, something that eliminates the fear of death. And I give you pointers and indications in those early chapters, and again here at the end, the Anthony Cheen production YouTube channel, Anthony Cheen, C-H-E-N-E, production, Anthony Cheen production YouTube channel, many videos where he interviews people who died, they flatlined, they were dead for minutes, and came back and described what's on the other side to such an extent that it's easy to believe when we die, we just become more conscious. We just see more of what's really here. And then we're free, like Gail was echoing and reaffirming for me, once you're free of death, like John F. Kennedy, once you've reconciled death and you will do what's right because it's right, you have a freedom and an untouchability and an imperturbability that will take you places. It might bring you into the crosshairs because that upsets the apple cart of these psycho lunatics. I'm riffing here. We have to do whatever it takes. If you intend to exist and enjoy life, do whatever it takes to figure out how to love every single moment of every single thing that's going on in your life, including current events. Energy seems to have a holographic nature. I mentioned this before. Every part seems to have all the properties of the whole. Emerson seems to have intuited that in 1841 when he wrote in History of the Universal Mind, each individual man is one more incarnation. all its properties consist in him. It's like whatever is in earth is in every tree. It's in every dandelion. It's in every flower. Whatever that is. So whatever there is of the universal mind, he's saying, is in each and every individual. Holographically, everything might come with everything, left with right, up with down, the intention to exist with the intention not to exist, because everything is everything. Each individual unit is a representation of the whole infinite everything. Everything is the one thing that exists, which is love. Infinite, eternal, non-ending, every variation you could possibly imagine, forever existing all at once, all here. When we respond to love, we respond to ourselves. When we respond with love, we respond with ourselves. President Lincoln was told not to speak kindly of Southerners. They were enemies who must be destroyed. He replied, "Don't I destroy my enemies when I make them my friends? The survivor of the Nazi concentration camp, the guards couldn't make me stop loving them. My mind, I'll think what I want. I choose who I love." If God is love, if I withhold love from someone, I'm withholding God from someone. If everything is seamless and we're all one, if I withhold God or love from that person and judge them, I'm judging and withholding and severing and cutting off love from a part of myself. If I hate someone, like Nixon said when he resigned, when you hate someone, then you destroy yourself. Because we feel what we give. You can't give something you don't have. Might as well be love. Hope belongs to the humble, those who know that they know not. Harry Truman said, the only thing new in the world is the history you don't know. In a letter to his friend, Carl Seelig, Einstein wrote, "I have no special talents. I am only passionately curious." His son-in-law, Dmitry Marianov, wrote about Einstein's work, "Time and space are modes by which we think, not conditions in which we live. Time and space are the universe." If Dmitry was right, the universe is the mode by which we think. It is our mind. Me talking to you is the universe talking to itself. Einstein also wrote, "There are only two ways in which to live your life. One as though nothing is a miracle. The other is as though everything's a miracle." Back to this, me talking to you is the universe talking to itself. I contend, I like to imagine, that you hearing me is no different than a thought that comes to your mind as you're falling asleep or as you're waking up. That the turning on the radio, real spiritual advisors say, notice the coincidences. Notice the coincidences. And pray, open your mind, calm your heart, and say, show me what I need to see. Teach me what I need to know. You'll be in line at the grocery store, and you'll hear someone say, well, I would really forgive her in that situation. Two people talking. But it's exactly what you're thinking about. You get the clue. There's only one mind in this model. Is that it? Good golly. Yep, that was it. I want to go back to that last slide. That was so pleasant. Hold on. I didn't know I was at the end. Boom. There we go. Where is it? Whoops. I thought I had one more slide. Who's got the first question?
Bruce, this is Casey again. I'll tell you, you've kind of lit a fire in me a little bit. I am dead tired, but my wife came in here and she says, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm listening to one of the most interesting presentations I've heard in a long time." I said, I told you I was a psychology minor, but it took me back to my philosophy courses back when I was a sophomore. And I'm sitting there going, man, I was questioning every damn thing in the universe. When did I stop? Okay? Well, when I became oriented and put in a box, and then after my second year of teaching, I had to sit back and say, you know, I am not going to teach like I'm in a box. I'm going to open up. And so I reverted back to that. But, you know, it's one of those things. And I have to agree with Brooks, you know, I grew up kind of like Brooks did a little bit, you know, where you were regimented. And also, what was it? I was a baseball coach for 45 years and I was lucky enough to be around about five state championships. And I always told the people who were interviewing me, you know, who was responsible for all that. Well, really in the back of my mind, I was ready to tell them, though, hell, you're looking at him right here. I'm the one who put it together. I'm the one who did this. Well, I never did that. I always gave it to the kids. But again, at the same time, you sit back and you think to yourself, well, I was the leader in that session, but I'm no good unless I have somebody to lead. And the other thing is, my kids all sat back and they go, you know, what would happen if we actually took our state championship team and did it without any coaches? And I said, you want to try it? Go ahead. And, of course, they were pretty well seasoned at the time, and they did pretty good, but God dang, they got in some hellacious fights, you know, over who was going to do what. Well, I'm older. You know, here we go. So you need somebody to step in, kind of like what Brooks was saying a little bit, and somebody's got to lead you to whatever you want, you know, whatever your goal is. But yeah, interesting concepts there, and then how we all live our lives and how we're boxed in and how we're still boxed in today. I mean, God forbid, I don't want to pay any more taxes than I have to. In fact, I don't want to pay any taxes. But, you know, I'm regimented into that because I'm already doing this stuff. And I know I'm not going to get out of that, maybe unless I win the lottery. But even then, I still have to pay taxes. So,
yeah.
But thank you for your presentation.
Thank you, Casey.
Bruce, I think one of the things that, you know, I definitely think that not only myself, but I think a lot of people, you know, when they've sat here for the last almost 4 hours and also what they'll see on YouTube is the fact that, you know, your book and your presentation, it really makes people think. It's not strictly just about the JFK assassination. Like I said, when I introduced you earlier, at 6 o'clock, this is not strictly about, you know, trajectories and bullets. It's more than just that. And I just want to say, you know, congratulations on a great presentation. And I think you're going to definitely, reach a lot of people in their free thinking. And that's one thing that we do have with freedom is free thinking. And I hope a lot of people get a chance to watch this video and read your book and think for themselves. So I want to say thanks again for joining us this evening.
Thank you. My pleasure. My an honor. Truly.
And does anybody else? I see Lori Fenton. She's said in the comments section, wonderful presentation. She wants to thank you and thank us for that. She's late for work, but it was well worth it, she said. So, you know, it's all about us coming together and having a forum to talk on, not just strictly, you know, during assassination weekend, but also, you know, every month throughout the year. So.
Thank you. What?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, just your previous comments reminded me of Larry's blender, because it takes – This thing called life, I need all your perspectives. I needed the perspective in all the books that I read, all the lectures and seminars that I watched on YouTube about all these kind of things. And it's just mind blowing to see what people make out of this thing called life. These are kind of camping for the weekend kind of conversations. The night around the campfire, just talking about like, well, what's it all about and what's it all mean that we used to do so much when we were teenagers, things like that.
Absolutely. Gail, you've got your hand up. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to say that thank you very much for this. This has really been great for me because I am a dot connector, and I spent most of 2020, you know, really drilling down and going down all these rabbit holes and trying to understand the inconsistencies and the agenda and so forth and so on. And then I realized that I needed to go back in history and see the continuity of how this all evolved, dating. And I went back to the Civil War. Initially, I read a couple books and you're so absolutely right on about reading and research. And I just saw some similarities there, how it's all evolved. And then I went on to Kennedy, and lately I've been into the 9/11 thing. I've been watching and researching and getting the nuances and how they were able to perfect the use of super nanothermite and their ability to truly do magic with chemical reactions and how that could potentially translate into bioweaponry that could be used on humans and everything. And I just find it so fascinating that you have taken this approach, because that's the way my mind works in a holistic manner. And I think that ultimately this has been a spiritual war all along, since we were shocked by that horrible day on November 22nd, 1963. We were shattered. Our world was shattered. And in order to come to grips with it, we need to do this kind of holistic thinking and work to look back in our history. And let me tell you, it is hard work. I don't think a lot of people have the stomach for it. They go down these rabbit holes. They find, and they're dead ends, or they don't dare to look any further because it's too painful. And it has been depressing as hell, some of the things that I've learned. But I've stuck with it, and I'm starting to lift myself up by talking to other people and listening to other people. And to know tonight that you share this kind of approach, it means that I'm not alone, that perhaps we are having an evolution of consciousness, that we can come to a greater understanding of what it is that the universe is trying to tell us, so that we can change this, so that we can turn this ship around.
Two things, Gail. Three things. One, thank you. Two, the universe is trying, all the universe, in my theory, all the universe can say is I am. It exists. That's
yeah.
It. And we are most like it when we do the same. Third, on TrineDay.com, I think you especially would love every single episode of my publisher, Chris Milligan, interviewing all his, about 70 of his authors. I help with each episode. I introduce the episode and I ask the question at the end. But to your point, you are not alone. And that's the joy and the thrill. Like I said, when I was at that open mic, and first I was just talking about energy and love and consciousness, and there's only love and everything's okay. You know, this is a creative realm. There's nothing but heaven. There's nothing but the God energy, whatever, whatever. That went over nice, really nice. And then I started talking about all this too. And most people don't care. Some would say, I think you're crazy. I'd say, okay, thank you. Yeah, next beer's on you. And young people would come up to me and say, we know all this. We didn't expect to hear it here. So good for you talking about it. You are not alone. You're definitely not alone. And yeah, thank you.
Another thing, Bruce, you know, speaking of what you spoke of earlier, I think some of the generation that is, you know, my kids' generation, and maybe my daughter's generation, even though they're all my kids, but there's about a 7-year age gap between them. But the fact of it is, kids just don't read these days. You know, they, I think the library is kind of an archaic idea for them, unless they're forced to go there to write a term paper, and sometimes they just Google it and get it off of Wikipedia. But if the younger generation, and not only them, but the adults as well, would just go back to reading, I know me and Casey and Brian, you know, we've always got a book in our hands, researching something, reading something. So definitely, if we could get the kids to do that, that would be a godsend, so to speak. So.
Yeah, I praise reading like crazy in my school chapter. Not from what it's done for me, but just the development of a mind. It takes language. It takes words to be able to define our emotions, because we are emotional, you know, wild animals when we're kids, and we're wild animals our whole life with raging emotions if we can't articulate it. I mentioned Brad Pitt's character in my book from the movie Burn after reading. He's got the vocabulary of a four-year-old, and he's as dumb and out of control and as impressionable as a four-year-old, because like Orwell said, you can't think well if you can't write. And that's what writing does, because then you can identify your emotions, because 90% of the battle is who and what, how we are being us, whether it's dealing with the fear of the current events or the trauma from our childhood that we don't even remember because it happened before we were 7 years old, which is why the classic advice on the temple, know thyself, do the work, do the dirty work. Why do I feel like, why am I always triggered? Why am I unhappy? Why do I feel like I need to drink? Why do I need these antidepressants? Blah, 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 blah.
Good point. Good point. Does anybody else have any questions for Bruce that you'd like to ask, or any comments? Well, I guess no questions, no comments. I think you've answered everything. Plus, you've got people thinking, and that's the most important thing. That's what we want people to do when they see one of our programs, is to actually think for themselves and come up with answers to questions that they may have, not only on the JFK assassination, but other things as well, especially things that deal with history. I guess with that, we will close our event tonight, but I do want to make sure that people, join us not only on the replay tomorrow, it'll be up online, if not later this evening. Depends on the miracle of Zoom and the internet. But also, remember everybody that December the 18th at 1 p.m. Central Time is going to be our next journey meeting. And, you know, if you came to our event, I see some new faces tonight, join us each month that we have something going on, because you never know what's going to pop up and what's going to be discussed. So great information that you might miss out on. And if you miss out on the live event, there's always the replay. So with that, I want to say thanks again to Bruce DeTorres. And again, if you have not picked up a copy of his book, please do so. And visit the Trine Day website. There'll be a link on our affiliated tab for Trine Day. I don't know why there's not one there already, but it was a oversight. There will be one there in the next 24 hours. But you can also go to Bruce's website, brucedetorres.com. And with that, I want to thank everybody in attendance and everybody watching this on the replay. Again, I'm David Knight with Project JFK CSI Dallas, and my co-directors, Casey Quinlan and Brian Edwards. I would like to thank everybody for the evening's presentation.
Thank you all. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. See you all next time.